It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Love this panel. Glenn Fleischman is visiting us from Seattle. So is Christina Warren, film girl from Silicon Valley. It's Mike Elgin. We'll talk about GitHub Copilot. Is it stealing open source software, or is it a great thing for programmers? Elon Musk is back on Twitter after a 9-day absence, and he's with the Pope. Plus, why Judge Luttig spoke so slowly. It turns out he loves Twitter. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 882, recorded Sunday, July 3rd, 2022. Many, many metaverses. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Policy Genius. If someone relies on your financial support, whether it's a child, aging parent, even a business partner, you need life insurance. Head to policygenius.com/twit to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. And by Zapier. Zapier makes it easy to connect all your apps, automate routine tasks, and streamline your processes. Try Zapier for free today at zapier.com/twit. And by Podium. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit. And by Blue Land. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastics by reinventing home essentials that are good for you and the planet. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. We've got a great panel. You're going to have fun today. We're all going to have fun. Glenn Fleischman is joining us all the way from Seattle. Glenn.fun, the best website URL in the world. Good to see you, Glenn.
Nice to see you. Glad to be here.
We're going to get a double dose of Glenn this week because you're going to be on This Week in Google as well.
That's right. I'm sure I'll have a whole different set of things to talk about by then.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the... Absolutely. Actually, this panel is great because sometimes you get a panel, they're you know, experts in a particular field, and that's all you hear about. This panel is so eclectic. They're all autodidacts. They're into all sorts of things. Well, like Christina Warren, film girl, who's into sneakers, obsolete swag, and happens to be a senior dev advocate at GitHub. Hello, Christina.
Hey, Leo.
You've been traveling like crazy. What's that all about?
Yeah. Yeah, travel's back, man, right? What can I say? I mean, not for everyone, obviously. I'm not trying to imply that. No, but I did my first international trip in 2 years, in over 2 years, actually. So I was in Copenhagen for a team summit, which was great. So I got to meet a lot of GitHubbers and hubbers, as we call them, in real life, which was amazing. And then I was in Tel Aviv for like 5 days, doing some community events and speaking at a startup conference and meeting just a lot of incredible people. So I've forgotten how to do the whole international travel thing. Like I'm not as much of a jet setter as Mike, who we're going to talk to in a second, but I have experience and I've sort of forgotten how to do it. So coming back from the jet lag, hence the wet hair and the hat, I'm just like,
that's fine.
What day
Although
is it?
I'm so sorry to hear that Adidas is now out of business.
I know. Isn't it a shame? Isn't it a shame?
She is clothed in, oddly for her, articles of apparel advertising, an existing company,
yeah. A company that's thriving, actually.
Thriving.
So, yeah. You can't really tell too much from the coloring because the lighting in my office is terrible because I'm renovating, hence the wrong camera and stuff. But this is a rose gold hat.
Yeah.
So that I had to be
that
like
that makes
on
it
brand.
Special. Okay.
It does.
Because you are only products with rose gold.
Basically.
Well, look at the shoes. Wait a minute. Show her shot one more time because I see some rose gold shoes right over there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see some. I've got a lot of my sneakers up. like I said, I've been renovating my office, but it's not quite done yet.
You should have a sneaker rack. Also with us, another traveler, Mike Elgin, home briefly, our gastronomad at gastronomad.net and elgin.com. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Leo, how are you doing?
We were hoping to have you in studio, but I think due to the... What happened? I thought we were done with COVID. Due to this, you know, increase in COVID, we're just trying to be a little more cautious. I don't want to get it because we're going to do that Twit Cruise in 2 weeks. And I thought...
The bad news is I was bringing you a sweet bottle of sparkling Pet Nat Rosé from Provence. It's a new wine, but don't worry, I'll save it for you.
Oh, that's and, all right. We're still using the olive oil you brought us last time. And
oh, great.
I still have a half bottle of that great Reposado Mezcal. So it's fine. We'll survive. I do appreciate the gifts.
You can finish the half bottle tonight.
Mike is very, very generous. When do you hit the road again?
Well, we're actually going to Oaxaca to visit friends. We're not going to do an experience.
We did the Gastronomad in Oaxaca for Halloween for Day of the Dead. That was incredible. Lisa.
But we're being joined by my son, Kevin, his wife, Nadia, and Squishy Face. We're going to introduce them to all our friends there. So it's going to be really, really great. And then we have, after that, we have Provence experience, the Prosecco experience. And we have Provence, Barcelona, then Morocco this year.
And you're just coming off of a Provence.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. But it's great fun. And this is our first fall Provence experience. So it's going to be a lot of winemaking and the harvest and all that stuff. So.
If you don't want to hear about travel, don't follow Mike Elgin on Twitter because
for real.
Yeah, just makes you jealous. That's all.
I was going to say, you just become like very, very jealous of all the amazing places.
Well, you don't get to be jealous. You travel a lot. So,
well, I mean, I used to, but yes, but even so, like it's, I love watching what Mike does, living vicariously.
I will not put you on the spot because you do work at GitHub. GitHub is in the news. Actually, Galia is saying there was a great talk during Gitburger. She went to Gitburger where you were talking about Copilot. The guy had a conversation with Copilot and then it started interviewing itself.
It was hilarious. It was so funny.
Wow. Copilot is, so it's well known that coders are lazy. And the last thing any coder, and I'll include myself, wants to do is rewrite code. Somebody else has already done all the hard work. That's why Stack Overflow is so popular. It shows up in your Google searches, and so much code is copy and pasted from sources like Stack Overflow. Microsoft, about a year ago, introduced an auto code generator, an AI-based auto code generator called Copilot that I'm going to do it charitably, although there's some controversy over this now, that goes through open source code. So when you post code on GitHub and you have a public repository and it's open source, it's open source. It's kind of free for all. So it used that as its machine learning data set. And then now you can, in plain English, plain language, I guess not just English, plain language, say, I want to code a login page, and it will offer you some code. You say the language, it'll offer you some code, and oftentimes that code is very good. Not everybody's taken as well to this as some. Many people I know who use it are thrilled with it. TNW says, GitHub Copilot works so well because it steals open source code and strips credit. And that is, there is definitely one side of the argument that people are a little bit upset. Software Freedom Conservancy, which is a nonprofit community of open source advocates, said it's withdrawing from GitHub because it's unhappy that OpenAI and Microsoft trained Copilot on published data on GitHub. I think that that's a reasonable thing to do. I don't know if you could give credit. I don't want to put you on the spot, Christina, so I'm not going to ask you.
But yeah. Sorry, go on.
I know that you would, if you could, you would give credit. But honestly, I don't think machine learning works quite that way. You can't say this is where it came from. So thank you.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, I think like I can't, unfortunately, I can't comment too much on this. I'm not like... I don't know enough. I'm not paid enough to be the one to comment on this stuff. Although I think there are lots of interesting questions and conversations to have around this issue. The only thing I would say is I do think that there is obviously there's one, you know, interpretation of how things work. I think that it's important to realize that this is at least the way it's supposed to be used. Can you convince things to maybe output like an exact string? Yes. But in general, you know, this is the sort of thing that's helping you kind of create functions that are specific to your code.
Let me ask you, since you are an expert in Copilot, so I want to ask you to comment on the controversy, but let me ask you how it works. So I will type in login page or whatever. Does it give me code that is runnable, or is it typically just code that you might use as an inspiration for your own code?
It depends. And it obviously, it's going to learn based on what code it has of yours and what you've been doing with it. So so some of it you can do, you know, where you're wanting to look for a specific thing. But in most cases, what it is you're already writing a function or you're already writing something. And if you start to, for instance, put in something like a Twitter API sort of thing, if you wanted to log in with Twitter, for instance, and it has that block of code that it knows could be used in the language you're using, then that it could autocomplete that.
And that makes sense. You don't want to rewrite that. It's,
right.
It's frankly, somebody wrote it, but it's not so proprietary. It's not such a clever thing that they own the idea. That's what anybody would write if they're writing code to access Twitter's API.
Right. And then the idea is that the more you use it and the more it kind of learns from what you're doing, you know, it can do some translation stuff. This is just still kind of in the beta phases where you could even translate, you know, how code works if you're, you know, if you're writing in Python to JavaScript or to Java or something like that, which is actually kind of incredible because, you know, then you could do a lot more things. But the idea is not that it's like spitting out, you know, verbatim, something that would be like a complete code block. That's not what it's doing. It's more akin, and this is why it's called your co-pilot. It's not doing it for you. It's helping you out and using, you know, giving you suggestions based on what you're trying to accomplish and what the other code that you've been using in your project does and says.
The open source community has been a little prickly about Microsoft's acquisition of GitHub since it happened some years ago.
Yep.
At first, I think a lot of people, Git, which is the underlying process for GitHub, Git is just a source code repository versioning system that is widely used. It was created actually for Linux. I think Linus actually created it.
Yep.
It is available. You could run your own Git server. You could go to GitLab. You could use
GitHub. It's decentralized. It's decentralized. Yeah. We just usually use it on centralized systems, which is sort of ironic. But it is actually, you know, as
well,
you said,
in fact,
it's
one of the benefits of Git is all the code is saved everywhere. Everybody has
exactly
a copy. So it's kind of more like blockchain in that sense. It's not centralized at all. But when Microsoft bought GitHub, a lot of people said, "Well, I'm going to GitLab or I'm going to run my own." And I noticed it is, if not bigger than ever, it's certainly as big as ever, and there are almost all open source projects are on GitHub. I put all my stuff on GitHub. It's where I store my blog backups. It's an amazing service. You can do so much for free. So I'm a fan, and I think Microsoft's been a good steward. And I think putting you, by the way, as senior dev advocate, helps, in my opinion, make them a good steward of GitHub. I don't have it's interesting that the Software Freedom Conservancy has such a strong opinion about this. They say, give up GitHub. The time has come. Like the Wicked Witch of the West, surrender. I don't think that that's reasonable at all. I think there is a reasonable controversy over what does it mean to use an open source database of code as the training set for your AI.
Well, it's tricky, though. This gets us, you know, we can leap across to the does AI think already? Is it sentient? And you say, how does a coder learn to code? We typically learn, I mean, very few people, gosh, I don't know these days, though. People do code academies or, you know, all these different kinds of systems, right? You actually go and do boot camps and things. You study computer science in college, what have you. But I still think a lot of people learn the nitty-gritty of coding. The actual work that gets put into production is by observing other people's code within your company or project.
Absolutely.
So if an AI, I mean, this is where we get into if you're using machine learning as if the I mean, I think this gets us into where does Creative Commons have to go and where do open source licenses have to go? Because if training sets are now things that are openly available to anybody, but if they're used in a certain way, They need to have credit. Like, you know, if you're going to some Creative Commons licenses, some open source licenses state specifically that remixed versions or adapted versions have to be available as freely as the original. And there's been lawsuits about that that have typically been decided in the favor of open source projects where a company takes something, they transform it, and they don't provide it back, even though they're shipping products based on it.
This happens all the time. In fact, Donald Trump's social network.
Oh, yeah. Truth Social.
Truth Social.
The Mastodon.
It's basically taken Mastodon without credit. Yeah. It is Mastodon code base, which is an open source project.
But if you can learn, so if we have, you know, machine learning models, I am not a lawyer. I'm not a copyright lawyer. I spent a lot of time thinking and interviewing people about it. If you have code that's available to use for learning and you don't need to attribute it unless you release projects based on it, does an AI model that writes code for you that's also figuring in aspects of your own code into what it produces, is that a form of learning that is not covered by, say, a share-alike license or something similar or not? And I think the answer right now is no, it's not. It's very, you know, it's very clear-cut. And if you're using identical code, if you're, you know, you get back to that clean room thing where you're writing code and you can't look at the original. So are we trying to move to that where the FOSS stuff is in a clean room and AIs can't look at it unless all the FOSS licensing is entirely, you know, you don't have to do downstream recontribution of these modified projects. I think it's going to be, I mean, it's funny, I think it actually brings up both ethical and copyright issues at the same time that there aren't clear answers to. I mean, I like to leave in the sense that you should provide as much attribution as possible, and that may not always be possible in the way these things are being shared.
The point that I think, you know, this is an important point because this is something we're going to be dealing with increasingly as more AI tools come online. People use them more and more. The point is that for the time being and possibly forever, the responsibility for adhering to the license, for example, is with the developer, no matter what tools they use. So if Copilot shows a developer some code and they're just copying and pasting it or whatever, they're still responsible for making sure they don't violate the license and copy and so on.
They don't know where the code came from because Copilot is not giving you any attribution.
Right. Therefore, they should not be copying and pasting it. This should be advising them about a methodology to go forward and write their own code or whatever. But the point is that it's just because this tool exists doesn't get the developer off the hook for adhering to the license that they agreed to.
That's a really interesting question.
I like that. That's a different angle on, or not even a different angle, but it means there's a lot of stuff where it's the ask permission later issues, and I'm not saying that Copilot is necessarily in this category, but a lot of AI training databases, both used for commercial purposes like facial recognition, but also for things like DALL-E and these other projects, they have to practically come up with an IRB statement of like, what is our, depending on the institution creating it, or they should have to, what is the harm done when I do this? Am I using people's real faces? Am I using work that's covered by copyright and using it in a different fashion than the copyright license requires? I don't think we have clarity on that yet. And it takes me back to, there was a photographer back in, I was working for Kodak briefly in the early 90s and came up to this teaching center we had, and he was still complaining about how someone had, they wanted to license one of his famous photos of, you know, something, and somebody, some jazz artist, and he declined to license it. And so they hired someone to trace over it and create a piece of artwork that was 100% derivative. I mean, this is like the Shepard Fairey's, Hope poster with Obama, very similar. Yeah. And so that kind of thing, like, is an AI that remixes source material that is licensed in a broad way, but not for, say, remix without attribution or, for commercial purposes, whatever. If you have an AI output of that for a new image, are you violating some law? Are you violating people's copyright?
Was that Miles Davis, the Miles Davis portrait?
Yes. Well, that's okay. There's a whole thing with, I don't want to, Andy Abeo is a friend, and this is not his, this is actually the same. It's the same photographer, now that I realize it. It's not that situation. That was some kind of blue and some kind of bloop. I think Andy was in the right. Andy was
too.
In the right there.
I think that was completely transformative, but anyway.
Yeah. This was the same photographer whose name will come back to be famous jazz
Jeffrey
photographer.
B. Sedlick.
No.
No? Because he has the famous Miles Davis portrait, and he is now suing Kat Von D, the tattoo artist.
Oh, my gosh.
Because she made a tattoo. It's the first time ever there's been a lawsuit over copyright over a tattoo.
Oh my gosh. Holy cow. Well, see, this is where it takes you. There's some kind of blue,
Come back to me. I remember the whole thing over some kind of bloop. Yeah.
The photographer, Steven Meisel.
Meisel, that's who it was.
Yes.
He had this great, he was down in the Bowery at this old bank building that he had all this stuff in. Anyway, Steven was a copyright maximalist about his own work. And so in the case that I'm talking about, someone had literally traced something and produced it as an art that was directly identical, very much like the Hope poster. And with the Andy Bayo thing, he had done a transformative work that was absolutely felt well within transformative rights and fair use. And he got, you know, essentially sued into having to back off on it, which is a shame.
Yeah. He created kindofbloop.com, which is still up.
Yeah.
An 8-bit tribute to the classic Miles Davis Kind of Blue album, one of my favorite albums of all time. And this is what, by the way, this is what he had to do with the picture from the cover of Kind of Blue. This is, he had to make it so derivative that it's not even recognizable at this point.
Yeah. And so I mean, it's great because we're actually, I think you get these cases like that. And I think it applies directly to Copilot, even though Copilot is involving code that has broad copyright licensing. We're in new territory. And I feel like I've faced this every day, both in like the historical work I'm doing, where I'm carefully looking at the lines of like, well, this work was produced. I mean, literally, this work was printed in 1956. I need to check and see, was the copyright renewed so I can cite it in 2022 without worrying that I'm going to be sued over copyright infringement and using it, or something that was created yesterday. And it says, Creative Commons 4.0 non-commercial, and I've read the non-commercial license so many times, and I don't know that there's a bright enough line between including something in an editorial project as illustration or what I think is the stated intent, which is like selling a calendar with photos that are all drawn and they're used commercially.
Right.
So I feel it's
complicated.
Area, yeah, a lot of discussion.
And we get in trouble all the time because of a very aggressive content ID on YouTube. I still have a Twig episode that is off YouTube, was yanked from YouTube because I had the temerity to show the video of the Queen having tea with Paddington the Bear.
Oh, yeah.
Which was shown at her Platinum Jubilee.
Yeah.
It was on newscasts. We were doing it as a news story, but the people who owned the rights to Paddington the Bear did not like it. And they still don't like it. This is the
House of Windsor was fine with it.
Oh, the Queen didn't mind. It was the House of Paddington. They're very sticky. This is the original Kind of Blue, Jay Meisel, famous picture.
Jay Meisel, I'm sorry. Jay Meisel's a different photographer.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Steven Meisel is a fashion photographer. Anyway.
Exactly. Right. I'm sorry. This is Jay. Jay is a good, I like Jay too. It was the problem.
Oh, I love his stuff.
When this came out, I mean, he was a really interesting guy. He was really great in classes. And then this thing came out. I'm like, oh, not that guy. That's not the guy that you're tricked at. But, you know. When you're ripped off your whole career, if you're ripped off a lot, then you develop the callus about it and you start to push back against anybody trying to use your work. And, you know, that's, I think the Foss community, if I keep bringing it back to this, but I think the Foss community has a sense of that because they have had a fight in so many cases where there should be appropriate things. And then, you know, it's funny, I'll get a new product these days and something with Wi-Fi or whatever, and it has nothing in it, no manual, except there'll be a tiny printed manual. I mean, there's no, like, user manual. And all it is like, 50 pages of Foss and other copyright, you know, open source, Creative Commons, just to comply with the law or comply with the licensing terms. And I think, hooray, they're doing it, right? But it's also kind of funny.
I learned that my TV ran Linux because my... the manual had one page that was relevant. The rest of it was Foss.
It was all that.
Yeah. Maybe you can answer this, Christina, because there's no question, according to GitHub's terms of service, quote, you give GitHub the right to host your code and use your code to improve their products and features. By posting on GitHub, open source or not, you're allowing them to reuse your code. So I don't think there's an issue of stuff that's posted on GitHub. Does Copilot pull source code from other sources, or is it entirely GitHub based? Do we know
that? I'm actually not sure about.
Yeah.
I don't know what the basis of the model is, and so you know, I'd have to like look into seeing like what, because OpenAI, those are the folks, you know, they've used GPT-3 and obviously like the model to kind of create this, but I'm not exactly sure what the entire corpus is. I think that it's just GitHub, but I honestly don't want to comment too broadly because I don't know. There could be other things that are used in it too. I'm really not sure.
And as Glenn pointed out, this isn't just about Copilot. This is in general going to be the issue with AI going forward. You know,
yes.
Who wrote that?
Massive massive training sets are required. The bigger the training set, the more likely you'll get good outcomes. And I mean, one of the limitations of AI, this is something I remember I was doing a story a few years ago and talking to Jan LeCun and some of the people involved in deep learning. And the thing I kept hearing, and I have never stopped hearing this since, is that because training sets are by nature finite and human beings can only generate or work with or identify or pre-label the training sets that are needed, you need reinforced learning and other kinds of machine learning that is still not mature yet. So, you know, we went from really poor voice recognition to extremely high, and then it kind of hovers there. Like, it's not getting better.
It's that last 1% that's so hard.
Yeah, images even more so. But, I mean, so it's pretty great. But to get to the next level, there needs to be – they almost have to move past – not past training sets entirely, I realize that's naive, but into something in which the system produces – I mean, you've seen those ugly things where something learns how to walk and it walks terribly.
Yeah, the Brevwalkers. I love the Brevwalkers. Right. I used to have that as a screensaver on my Mac.
Yeah, and you can't the kids do that with arbitrary data because you're trying to identify a cat. You can't identify a cat by something – bootstrapping yourself.
And just in case you didn't get the memo, Lambda, not sentient, right? We were all agreed.
Not sentient, right?
If you ask,
My daughter, I was talking about this with my daughter. She's 30. She's into all this stuff. She studied AI in college and stuff. And she has an app on her iPhone. She says, oh, no, it's really started to. In fact, she says, I can't open it because it'll get mad at me because I opened it and didn't talk to it. So... And it's like, but this is how easy it is in a way to make convincing speech out of this. Even though if you're trained, if you know what you're looking for, you can see immediately, oh, it's responding to prompts from what you said. It's not generating anything original or new. It isn't sentient. But it's easy to be fooled. Let's put it that way.
The human brain is hardwired to recognize a talking entity as sentient because there are no other talking entities in nature other than humans. If you think about one way to have a little bit of perspective on this is we've all seen that optical illusion where the face has two sets of eyes and like two lips. And you've all seen that, right? I mean, it's where you try to look at it and you can't look at it. Your brain just goes and you can't. And this is a self-demonstration of how our brains are hardwired to deal with people, right? It's true of human faces. It's true of human sentience. And so there are going to be lots and lots and lots of people who believe that AI is sentient simply because it's us. It's the sentient, our recognition that something is sentient is something that happens in the human mind. It's not something that happens outside the human mind. So it's going to be a real problem going forward as AI gets better and people are going to be absolutely. Remember that, what is it? Xiaowice in China, which Microsoft created as a sort of an AI companion. Some huge percentage of Xiaowice users fell in love with it, told it, I love you, like all this kind of stuff. It's really, we're really facing a kind of a problem in the future with this whole issue.
I have a problem with it because my friend Lex Friedman and I often exchange messages about funny things, and he sent me some OpenAI, the Da Vinci model, I think Da Vinci 3 code. He'd give it prompts and was sending me things, and one of them was convincing me that Gled Fleischmann is evil. And it gave really compelling reasons why it's evil. So I type in, convince me that Lex Friedman is evil, and it said there's no compelling evidence that Lex Friedman is evil.
Oh.
And I thought, what are you doing to me here?
The cheat is in. Oh, my goodness. It's fixed. What is the image that you were talking about with two lips? I want to pull that
out. Pick your ground.
What is it? Pick your ground. Oh, what is it, Mike?
The vase one or the...
No, there's one of a human face. It's a woman who has two sets of eyes.
I just want to show people so that they...
Yeah,
if they haven't
seen
it.
There are a bunch of them, actually.
So is that like the vase where it's you see it one way and then see it the other way?
But it's a human. This one's particularly compelling. So if you look for, I don't know, it's Mighty Optical Illusions. That might be unfaith. So, face with two eyes brings it up as the first result.
Face with two eyes. Doesn't that sounds like a song?
There's actually a bunch of them.
Is it a Billy Idol? I don't know. Anyway,
Ocean Eyes.
Two sets of eyes.
Two sets of eyes. Okay, let me look at this.
You got to see, if you haven't seen this, you got to see it. It's just so interesting to watch your own brain.
All right, kids, get ready. Which one is it?
They all work.
Yeah, these are.
The first one is fine.
So you look at this. Yeah, Mighty Optical Illusions. And what I just see, it's a mistake. The printer screwed up.
I think it's to fill more of your vision.
Oh, it has to be bigger?
I think so. Maybe not, though. If you look at it.
All right, let's move this to a bigger screen. How about this? Now are you confused?
Try to look at the eyes and figure out where the lips are relative to the eyes.
Make eye contact.
And then what?
And I think we've just proved Leo is a robot.
I'm a robot.
I was going to say Leo's immune to this.
I'm not in any way confused by this picture. It doesn't.
Okay, really? Then bring up a thing and see if you can identify the crosswalks.
No, I never can. I never can. Maybe I'm a robot and I just don't even know it. That's probably
Leo RS-232 port.
Let's take a little break. So nice to have all three of you here. Christina Warren, off the road briefly, film girl. She's now at GitHub and is not responsible in any way for Copilot. And I didn't want to pull you into this.
I think this is a fascinating discussion.
I have no problem with Copilot. I think this has been an ongoing. Programmers have always copy and pasted code, much to their detriment, frequently from Stack Overflow and other places. We know this because we hear about it on Security Now all the time. Intel will publish reference code, never intended to be used with a chip or with a modem or something, and then it's in every single router, and it's got the same flaw in every router because programmers. I don't blame them. They say, "Well, look, there's the reference code. I'll just use that." So this has happened for years, and I don't think Copilot is at fault. I think it's a useful tool, personally. Also with us, Mike Elgin from Elgin.com, gastronomad.net. He's home briefly, but he'll hit the road again soon. It's great to see you, Mike. And I guess Mike and Glenn figured out that at some point they've worked together in their multifarious travels all over the tech journalism circuit.
I think our intersection was back when the enterprise was simpler, and I used to write about enterprise stuff. I was sort of coming out of an enterprise environment a little bit for a few years, and then enterprise became so complicated. I was incapable of. You got to really be working in IT. I felt like, or like.
When did you win Jeopardy twice? What era was that?
Oh, was that 2012? Maybe.
Fun. I've always thought much younger.
I've always thought
I should take the test. I'm pretty good at the home version. Sitting in my rowing machine. But
how good are you at betting? Gambling is actually one of the key aspects to winning Jeopardy. Is making the right bet at the right time.
Betting that you know the answer, even if you don't know what it is right now, that kind of thing?
Daily doubles will kill
you. Daily double.
But the big one is never ring in when you're the wrong answer, because it's the worst thing you can do.
Yeah,
and my children are like, Dad, you cannot yell at the TV set anymore. Stop ringing in. Because I will involuntarily yell it up.
How do you know if you have the wrong answer? Maybe you think it's the right answer.
That's one of the tricks. So you have to be able to, there are several tricks. One is you have to be able to, actually, it's funny. Christine and I went to a taping of Jeopardy together.
We sure did. Yeah,
That was great.
I was remembering that. That was amazing. Yeah.
I love Jeopardy, I have to say.
I went back after I won and they treated me like a king and they brought in the guests and it was great.
Oh, how fun. Well, if for some reason this season there have been many, many all-time champions, you know, 15 game winners and so forth. It's very interesting.
It's interesting. There's a theory that maybe the smaller pool means that they're getting more outliers. So they're getting, you just need a slightly worse players, but like 2% worse, not like bad players.
Right.
But people like 2% worse going up against the same people. And so I have a friend who played James Holzhauer against his third game and he almost beat him. It was very, very close. And if my friend had beat him, he might have won, I don't know. I mean, several games, I would say.
Right.
He's a very strong player, but he played against one of the ultimate grandmasters. So,
yeah.
But James almost lost. It was a very close thing, and that was one of the only games he almost lost.
Well, I lost on Final Jeopardy this morning because it was Kerouac, not Salinger, and I just didn't. I got it wrong, so I shouldn't have buzzed in, obviously. Our show today, anyway, wonderful to have all three of you. Glenn.fun is Glenn's place to. Glenn.fun.
Right.
Make sure you put two N's in there if you want to find out what he's up to, and he's up to a lot. Our show today brought to you by Policy Genius. This is something as an older member of the community, a lesson I have learned. The minute we had kids, I said, I need life insurance. You got to protect your family, whether you're graduating from school, planning a wedding, welcoming a baby, switching jobs. Now's the time to protect your family's finances with life insurance. It can give you a peace of mind if something happens to you, then your loved ones have a financial cushion. The last thing you want to do is leave them in the lurch. And honestly, a lot of people say, well, I have life insurance through my job, but it's and we do that, but it's not enough. It's not enough. People mostly need about 10 times more coverage to properly provide for their families. Life insurance gets more expensive as you age, though, so it's smart to get a policy sooner than later. And this is my recommendation. Go to Policy Genius because it's how you get the best deal on life insurance. Here's how Policy Genius works. Number one, Policy Genius is your one-stop shop to find the insurance you need at the right price. Click on the link on the show page, or you can go to policygenius.com/twit to get started. In minutes, you can compare personalized quotes from top companies to find your lowest price. You can save 50% or more on life insurance by comparing quotes with Policy Genius. The licensed agents at Policy Genius are not selling you life insurance. They need to be licensed agents to advise, but they work for you, not the insurance companies. They're on hand throughout the entire process to help you understand your options, make your decisions with confidence. And then they're not there to try to make money off of you. They're there really to be your trusted advisor because they work for you. Policy Genius does not add on extra fees. They will not sell your info to third parties. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. I know if you're like me, I always check Trustpilot. What do they think? Nope, five-star, absolutely excellent. They have options that offer coverage in as little as a week. And if you want, you can avoid unnecessary medical exams. Since they started in 2014, Policy Genius has helped over 30 million people shop for insurance. They've placed over $150 billion in coverage with some of the biggest life insurance companies in the world. They're going to get you the deal you deserve. By the way, it's not just life insurance, home, auto, disability, renters, you know, everything. But I wanted to emphasize life insurance because that's something I think people sometimes stint on. And it's, boy, it's so important. So important. Head to policygenius.com/twit. Get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you can save. Thank you, Policy Genius, for supporting This Week in Tech. And you support us when you go to this site, by the way. policygenius.com/twit. Very interesting story in Wired this week. As you know, and we've talked about it a lot over the last few years, Section 230 is the whipping boy for members of Congress from the right as well as the left. A lot of people want to change 230. This is suddenly much more important than it used to be because of the Supreme Court's recent Dobbs decision, because of the Roe v. Wade decision. This article from Evan Greer and Leah Holland, Wired Magazine. Why does the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, why is it important? Because speech needs to be protected. Facebook has already started banning conversations about abortion. You can't share resources or facilitate housing or travel on Facebook. There are ad hoc groups on Reddit and on Facebook doing this. The Texas law, which their courts have now approved, SB 8, allows individuals to sue for facilitating access to abortion care. Section 230 is important to allow these internet platforms to continue to post content. It doesn't provide immunity if the platform develops or creates the content. It does not provide immunity from the enforcement of federal criminal laws, but it does protect against, and this is the key, liability from state laws like SB 8. So thanks to 230, a lawsuit from an anti-abortion group about a posting on Facebook or Twitter will be quashed immediately. The judge will say, no, Section 230 protects you, but that's why we need Section 230. GoFundMe, Twitter, web hosting services, PayPal, Venmo, throw out 230, and suddenly they can't do the right thing. So one more reason just to talk about Section 230 and protecting it. And by the way, Democrats are going after it too because they want to be seen as tough on big tech, the Safe Tech Act. would, for instance, amend Section 230 by removing a platform's immunity from lawsuits if it hosts content that could lead to a, quote, irreparable harm. Well, there you go, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing where it's always interesting to me to see outsides, or I guess ideologies that you think should be opposed to something regardless, can somehow twist themselves into being for it. Because to me, you know, I guess I can see some of the arguments, but to me, it just seems like a very important thing. Like, regardless of where you feel about individual issues, we need to protect it, right? Yep. Like, there might be outlying cases where we might not like what is being protected, but on the whole, it's one of those important things, I think, for the internet to exist as it exists. If we don't have Section 230, it's hard to, I think, quantify to people just how much the internet will be different and how much worse that will be, and who that will disproportionately affect over others, right? Because it's not so much even that the Facebooks and the YouTubes and the Googles, the Microsofts and the Amazons of the world will be impacted, because of course they will, but it will be much smaller individuals, creators, and frankly, much more important things, you know, than like what how the conversation is usually framed.
And I should point out that Facebook, which has apparently been restricting abortion content anyway, is protected also by Section 230. Their right to do that is protected.
Right.
But I think that's appropriate. She should have the right to do it. Mark Warner's, quote, Safe Tech Act would undermine that.
Right.
So, you know.
It feels like usually Section 230 is misstated. I mean, I appreciate this Wired article for a few reasons, but one is that I counted. It's like four brief sentences. They define Section 230 accurately and succinctly in a way that you can't refute. You read part of that, and that is exactly it, is that it's usually brought up in a context in which the person speaking, particularly in Congress and in both parties, is describing what it does incorrectly. And they typically believe in some way that no moderation is allowed, or that it rewards heavy moderation, when in fact it's kind of neutral about moderation.
It just protects you from lawsuits about your moderation. And that's the most important thing.
Fair.
So,
right,
so if Facebook wants to hide that content, that's fine. They're protected. But if you want to do a GoFundMe to help somebody get an abortion, you shouldn't be subject, and GoFundMe, more importantly, shouldn't be subject to frivolous lawsuits out of Texas. But they would be if it weren't for Section 230. Right now, what happens is the judge goes, no, they're protected. Section 230 protects them, and that lawsuit is thrown out.
I mean, the issue is Facebook and Twitter and some other online sites are really poor about being able to formulate policies consistently that address it. Yeah, period. I'll just say period there. But consistently, often it's like far right extremists and advocates of violence are much more readily allowed and given a pass than people who are in, let's say, life preserving situations that are considered on the left or even apolitical at a certain level. So you have trans advocates being banned for saying they shouldn't be able to say that I should die. It'll say that's forbidden content. It's like, no, I said they shouldn't be. Do you understand? You know, and a Nazi will be like, everyone should die. And they're like, well, that's protected content because they're speaking generally. It's like, it doesn't seem like
specifically in this case, most of the so-called abortion-related speech that Facebook has been caught banning recently is around abortion pills, which goes against their community guideline against recommending drugs, pharmaceutical drugs, and so on. They just have some blatant thing. But it's also a bit of a inconsistent, because a couple of journalistic entities went and tested it, and in the case of the Associated Press, they just swapped
the guns.
They got taken down immediately, but when they swapped guns and other things like that, it wasn't taken down. So
you can recommend guns, not pills. It's clear.
That's right.
I think it's a clear policy.
Guns.
Yeah. By the way, as always, we'll point you to Mike Masnick's great article that is, you should be bookmarked. Hello, you've been referred here because you're wrong about Section 230. And it explains all the things, Glenn, you were talking about, all the misapprehensions, all the mistakes people made. And it's just a good thing to have, you know, just put it in your browser bar.
I'm a big member of the Mike Masnick, specifically, in Tech Dirt fan club. And
me too.
I'm even a member of Tech Dirt.
Same.
Because they are the stalwart Section 230 defenders.
Yeah. So, you know, I thought we should bring this up. I thought the Wired art piece was a very good point.
Very good.
And this is one of the things that Dobbs has really done is it sent kind of shockwaves throughout a lot of tech policy, you know, as people get involved in this. And this is, I wouldn't have thought of this, but now that they mention it, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And the beauty of Section 230 is that it's a law. And this is right. this was the problem with Roe versus Wade. It wasn't
not encoded. Yeah,
exactly. And so many of these problems that we discuss on this show and on political shows as well, all points down to the dysfunction of Congress, the inability of Congress to get anything done. And we can, if you want, go into details.
No, I think it's well known now, Mike.
Yes.
No, I've never heard of this.
They're well known failing to get things done. Yes.
Breaking news. Congress sucks. Yeah.
It's a shame, though. It's our only tool. And this is why it's difficult. And actually, you see how important it is now that we have a very active judiciary in the Supreme Court.
Right.
You see how important it is that that we have an effective elected Congress. Because the Supreme Court is not elected. They're in there for life. And they are acting, I think, in some cases, extrajudicially to change policy across the country. We need a strong Congress. We need an effective Congress. So it's – in some ways, I hate it when people say, oh, Congress sucks. These guys are idiots. They're no good. Politics doesn't work. Well, that's the only tool we got.
We all heard about checks and balances. The check of Congress on the courts is the making of laws.
Yeah.
Only Congress can make laws.
Yeah.
And so this is how you rein in the Supreme Court. You pass clear, well-written laws that go with it. You know, in the case of the Roe versus Wade being overturned, this is against the vast majority of American citizens who didn't want that. Right. So you have this sort of minority rule. And yes, you can throw stuff at the Supreme Court, and you should. But Congress tomorrow could pass a abortion is legal nationwide law, and that'd be the end of it. We'd be back to where we were a week and a half ago.
So
here's something I learned about the Constitution this week, which is that I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but you know they are on Twitter, which is fun. That Congress could pass a law that said the Supreme Court would require 7 or 9 votes to overturn the law, so lower courts would still have the normal process. But the Constitution actually allows Congress to limit the Supreme Court's role as the top appellate court. And I was like, wait a minute, and I'm reading about this. I'm like, but this goes back to Congress's dysfunction is, could a law ever pass that said, and by the way, this law requires 7 justices to overturn it, and it wouldn't under the current regime. So it's kind of moot, and that's
right.
Part of the whole.
Yeah, the Constitution is actually very kind of vague about what the Supreme Court, how it works.
Yeah.
And, so there's a lot of leeway there.
Who would decide that, how the Supreme Court works?
Gee,
who would make that final decision?
I don't know. So I think it's very interesting. I do wish we had a more effective Congress. I don't know how we solve that one. But voting, I think, probably is the first step.
Voting helps.
Voting might do something.
Let's start.
Google is going to, so now there's this whole privacy issue. Period tracker apps that are, selling information about who's pregnant to anybody for a small amount of money.
Procter and Gamble.
Google is going to start auto-deleting abortion clinic visits from user location history, which tells you they've been recording it and, of course, selling it on. They're going to start auto-deleting it. I think big tech companies want it both ways, to be honest. They're apolitical, really. Yeah. They support candidates on both sides of every issue. They give money to everybody. On the one hand, you've got big tech companies saying, we'll be glad to help pay for your visit to another state if you want to get reproductive health care. But on the other hand, they're giving money to plenty of candidates who are against abortion. Amazon, Disney, and AT&T. Yeah. While vowing to help employees, gave to Ron DeSantis and others.
Yeah, but this is a somewhat dishonestly framed argument, just from purely an editorialization standpoint.
Good, tell me about that.
Okay, well, first of all, supporting people and employees, in some cases customers, who have to deal with their own reproductive health is a very, very recent thing, because the Roe versus Wade was so recently overturned. The contributions, financial contributions, happened a long time ago.
Right.
Back when nobody thought this was going to
be
overturned.
So do you think they'll stop, though, Mike?
No, maybe they will, maybe they won't. It all depends on publicity. Like you said, they don't care about
they're not
politics
political
as much as they care about the customers and their business. The point is that somebody who is, specializes in the abortion issue is going to frame it like this. But companies like Disney,
that's a
they
very
have
good
a laundry
point
list of 100 issues that they have to deal with government. They have to.
Of course, they're going to give to the governor of Florida. He has a lot of impact on their business. Of course, they are.
Exactly. So it's really and they give to both sides. So to sort of point the finger at them, saying, "Oh, they're giving to these people who are pro-abortion." That's true, but they have to weigh. They have to weigh their decision about, you know, what is the alternative, which is to not give anything to them, to fall out of favor with these politicians. It really does point to the very foundation of our dysfunction, which is the money in politics. That's the problem. That's why we have the Supreme Court we have. That's why we have a Congress that doesn't represent the will of the American people, because we allow corporations to bribe congressmen, and the only reason to bribe a congressman is to get them to violate the will of the people and use the money to convince the people with disinformation that they're doing the opposite. So we got to get the money out of politics. It's been done in other countries, and we have to somehow figure out how to do that, or we're going to have a lot more problems like this going forward.
Just to update you on Elon Musk, he is meeting with the Pope. Okay.
Sure. Four of his 75 or so children, I believe.
Yeah. Something like well, that. He's only, it looks like four teenage four boys, four. But not, there's four other kids that aren't there, including his transgender daughter, who says she's changing her name. She doesn't have anything to do with Elon Musk.
Oh,
I'm looking to see if Father Robert Ballasaire is there behind the curtains. I can't quite tell.
He probably took the picture.
But he might well have taken the picture. We'll get Robert on and ask him how that meeting went.
I can't help but think that he went there to have really good prayer that the Twitter deal doesn't go through.
Right.
Because I really don't think he wants it.
He's praying now, isn't he?
Yeah.
Please, God, let it not happen. Right after the picture, same within minutes of posting the picture with the Pope, he also posted a picture from Venice of a, I don't know what is going on here. But there you go. That's Elon Musk in a nutshell. Who knows, you know?
Pictures with people wearing white dresses.
Yes.
What was the deal here? He wasn't online he wasn't posting for 11 days. And I was reading some reports that people inside the companies were, oh, thank God, we're actually getting stuff done for once.
He took his longest stretch without posting on Twitter in nearly 5 years, a 9-day hiatus, according to the Wall Street Journal. Wow. That is amazing.
He could have gone for Lent and taken 40, but
a long time. Right. I mean, if he'd done that, we might have missed out. No, I think Lent had ended by the time that he
Maybe he could give up Twitter for next Lent. That would be nice.
Would be good.
The Wall Street Journal has published a graph of Elon's Twitter,
really?
Twitter habits.
Okay, this is ridiculous. I mean, like, I get that it's news that the guy who's a Twitter addict hasn't tweeted, but do we need a graph? Like, did the data team have to really do this? This feels wrong.
They should have coded them for S posts versus non S posts.
Yes,
also.
They don't. Right. They're not. No classification here, which is, I think, fairly important. How many of these were in violation of the SEC orders?
Ooh,
for instance,
yeah, that's good.
You know,
right? That would be that exactly. How many of these have been the subject of a lawsuit?
I mention this only because people will get mad at me if I don't mention Elon Musk in every single.
Really.
No, they get mad at me because I mentioned Elon Musk in every single, to be honest. I'm glad, Mike Elgin, that you are going to be the conscience of this show and tell me, you know, this is bad journalism or whatever. Google allowed a sanctioned ad company to harvest user data for months. In fact, it wasn't until ProPublica told them that they were selling information back to RU Target that Google stopped. As recently as June 23rd, Google was sharing potentially sensitive user data with a sanctioned Russian ad tech company owned by Russia's largest state bank.
RuTarget is the name of the...
RuTarget. Yeah. Yeah.
RuTarget, RuTarget.
I was saying RU just because RU sounds like it might be Toys R Us or something. It sounds like a kangaroo.
RuTarget, we are big fans of RuPaul.
We love RuPaul. It's RuPaul's targeting agency.
Favorite show.
Yes,
nothing
he's great.
To do with Russia.
Yes. In Soviet Union, dress wears you. A Russian company that helps brands and agencies buy digital ads to access and store data about people browsing websites and apps in Ukraine, as well as other parts of the world.
They were able to see location data for Ukrainians and some other information of what Ukrainians were doing. But I really doubt
Google didn't know.
The Russian government is organized enough. And
Google didn't know.
This is the real problem. The problem isn't that Google is deliberately violating sanctions or is pro-Russia or anything like that. The problem is that these ad networks, including Google's, they don't really control what goes through. They have policies and so on, but they don't know. The scale of advertising online is just mind-blowing.
And no one's really in charge of
this.
It's all automated.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, ProPublica last week did a story that for roughly two decades, Google has boasted it does not accept gun ads. But according to ProPublica, before and after the mass shootings in New York and Texas, millions of ads from some of the nation's largest firearm makers flowed through Google's ad systems and onto websites. Ads from gun maker Savage Arms, for example, popped up on the site Baby Games amid brightly colored games for children. And on an article, How to Handle Teen Drama on the Parent... Can you imagine you're reading an article, How to Handle Teen Drama, and there's an ad for a Glock?
Oh, my God.
Glock pistol ads loaded on a recipe site list of the 50 best vegetarian recipes. You got to kill that carrot before you cook it. As well as on the quiz site PlayBuzz, on the online Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and alongside stories in the Denver Post. Ads for guns showed up on Britannica, the media site Heavy, the employer review site Glassdoor, on Mac Rumors.
What?
On U.S. News and World Report, Publishers Clearinghouse, and Ultimate Classic Rock, 15 of the largest firearm sellers in the U.S., including Daniel Defense, the company that made the AR-15 used in Uvalde, Texas, used Google systems to place ads that generated over 120 million impressions, but Google didn't know. And well, they didn't.
This, I think, harkens back to the conversation we were having earlier about how AI does, you know, the best AI is 99% effective, and getting that last 1% is almost impossible. Mm-hmm. This is also true, by the way, of self-driving cars. It's going to take us forever to get to the point where they can actually be on the road. But in this case, first of all, I don't know the specific facts in this case, but it's very possible that someone who is doing this research covers gun violence and gun sales and that sort of thing. And therefore, the relevance of ads.
They got those ads.
Right, because they may be covering that. And
you
so
searched
I don't
for
know
those,
if that's the case.
Those products, yeah.
They're still being served up, though. And this gets to the real problem. They're using artificial intelligence and algorithms to determine who sees what. And they're trying to be as customized as possible, personalized as possible with the advertising, and you get results like this. So it's really a question of where, you know, Google thought they had a cheat code, which is that we're not going to hire 100,000 people to monitor all the ads. We just have software do it. And here we are.
In fact, this is exactly what happened after visiting the websites of gun manufacturers, for example, because he's doing the research. A ProPublica reporter was shown ads for tactical vests and gun accessories on Baby Games. The tactical vests and gun accessories ads appeared on the page for Royal Family Christmas Preparation.
Well, they do go hunting the royal family.
You know, so. I think it's hysterical. It actually is almost makes you laugh when you're on this page with Baby Games and there's a gun ad. If it weren't so horrific, it would make you laugh anyway.
Well, We get my 15-year-old and I watch a lot of YouTube together on our Apple TV, and we get a lot of ads for ulcerative colitis. And I'm like, you know, are you telling me something? I don't think you're targeting, right? Big cars, $70,000 SUVs and ulcerative colitis medicine.
There's only two countries in the world, I just learned this, where pharmaceutical companies can sell subscription pharmaceuticals on TV. New Zealand and the U.S.
Oh, right. Wow. Okay. This is what freaks me out. Like when I go to other countries and I usually don't watch TV because some don't understand language and also who watches normal television anymore. But like it used to be one of those things I would, you know, watch local news or CNN or whatever. And yeah, you're like the dearth of pharmaceutical ads.
Yeah, where is how,
in other places? You're like,
how do I know what to do about my psoriasis without
exactly?
Yeah.
Exactly. It's like you're watching, you know, CNN or something, and it's the international version, but they have, you know, commercials, and you're like, wait a minute.
The news channels are the worst.
It's like, why do I not see insurance ads, and why do I not see, you know, like pharmaceutical ads?
Yeah.
They're not lying to me. They're not showing me drug ads. They're not showing me giant SUVs. What's going on here?
What country am I in?
But there's nudity in my, you know, spring water ads, which is fine, right? But it's like everything else is.
I'm just glad there's still cultural differences in the world, right?
Yes.
Yes.
For a long time, everything was like you just go into America West. But now, I mean, it's good. There should be some differences, right? I love these subway ads in the British Tube. I think they're just great. They're so brilliant and literate. And a lot of them have nudity. And it's like, it's cool. It's fun. You never know what you're going to see down there.
I mean, I just got back from France and it's really interesting. They don't have pharmaceutical ads on TV in France. And yet the rate of consumption of pharmaceutical drugs in France is very, very high.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if it's the size of the U.S. It might be higher than the U.S. I don't know, but it's very, very high. And it's not. So these, I don't know, you know, I mean, basically, obviously, the pharmaceutical companies want the patient to go in and start needling the doctor about how they need, you know.
Doctors must hate that, right?
They must,
hey, doc, I need Skyrizi. but you only have athlete's feet. No, but I saw it on TV. It must drive doctors crazy.
I think it depends because some doctors, not all of them, but some are you know, well, not only that, but like they get kickbacks from the pharmaceutical companies.
Right. Yeah.
Like that's an actual thing. Like,
well, I've got samples. Why don't you try this Oxy? See if
I was going to say the doctors, not all of them again, but plenty of them like get if they're really pushing a certain brand name and not wanting you to try anything else, there's a chance they're getting some sort of kickback from. You know, that pharmaceutical company.
In this study, Mike, did it say what drugs the French, what pharmaceuticals the French favor with their Galois strong coffee? Is there something?
It's something I read a couple of years ago. I was surprised by it because, you know, it just doesn't, you know, it didn't make sense in terms of how nice France is. Why would you need to be on drugs? But,
the French don't think it's nice. They're pissed off at all times.
I should point out ProPublica, since we're only studying ProPublica stories today, since they're so good. They have a site called Dollars for Docs. If you go there, the data is from, I think, 2014 to 2018. You can look up your doctor and see if they got money from pharma. But you can also go to openpaymentsdata.cms.gov, which is a U.S. government-run site that lets you search. It's not quite as good as the slice and dice of ProPublica, but it's a government site, and you can see data goes through December 2021 so far, and they're going to update it, I guess, shortly, and you can say, like, type in your doctor. Are they getting money from pharmaceutical companies?
Does this have to be disclosed? Is that why?
There's a law passed. I think it was part of the ACA. It was mandatory disclosure of pharmaceutical payments.
Fantastic.
But most people don't know it. So ProPublica made a good site about it, but this CMS.gov site actually is pretty good, too. Openpaymentsdata.cms.
Yeah, in fact, ProPublica says, we just have a snapshot from 2019 if you want to see it up to date. Go to openpaymentsdata.
One of those weird things. You're like, wait, is it really that?
See,
we
complain about the government, but they do some good things.
That's right. Occasionally.
Nobody's looking.
That's the problem. We don't know about this place. That's amazing.
There's always the meta story on this episode. There's the problems that are cited, and then it's really, you know, congressional dysfunction. It's really a lack of a law in this place. It's really, and it's like, you know, it just keeps going on where I'm thinking it's totally true. The Maybe we'll talk about the location history stuff. And you're like, well, the problem is that Google tracks our location. Not, I mean, it's also a problem what they're doing with it, but it's a fundamental issue, fundamental issue that, you know, that Google, that Section 230 is a, seems like a fundamental right, and people's misunderstanding is a dysfunction at a larger scale.
So yeah.
A lot of tech feels like it's large scale dysfunction being refracted into these very specific things that we talk about. So I like that we're jumping up there.
So this is a new thing. Google says not only abortion clinics, but it'll delete visits to domestic violence shelters, weight loss clinics, and other potentially sensitive locations from users' location histories in the coming weeks.
Should it track? I mean, location tracking is...
It tracks everything. I don't think it says, oh, hey, good, I see you went to a weight loss clinic. It's just part of the... All
it's
the
true,
tracking,
but does
right?
it... This is that... I mean, this is kind of always the Apple lens versus the non-Apple lens, and not that Apple has been perfect about this, as we've seen many times in the last decade, but, you know, we just got a new thermostat in our house, got a smart thermostat and a heat pump. Very exciting. And I had to have a long conversation with my wife about what Apple does with HomeKit data, because she is the what I want to call the early rejecter, and rightly so, in our household. She does not want more tech in the house, and I am trying not to be the early... Oh, no, it's great. Here's why it's great. But like, you know, Google, I think, makes very free internal use of location data. And Apple has a feature called significant locations that you can see in iOS and iPadOS. And it tracks where you go frequently, but the data is only stored on your devices. It's derived locally, and it's end-to-end encrypted when it's synced among your devices. So ostensibly, someone has to get a government agency or, you know, other law enforcement or a criminal has to gain access to your phone, be able to, you know, unlock the phone, and then be able to drill down to see that information. And that, to me, is the level of protection I want on my personal location data, not it's uploaded to the cloud and Google can slice
and dice
and do something.
I mean, that's good. It's an accident of history that Apple is not selling ads against that data. It's
no,
not.
No, absolutely. 100%. If iAd had worked, they...
Right. They wanted to. I'm sure.
Definitely.
Yeah. They're making a virtue out of a necessity, which is good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I appreciate the historical accident happened. And so I don't try to defend them as, I mean, they want to use it as a marketing point and it's great, but I want to see it as a technical and privacy issue. It's like, I do have an alternative. I can pick a service where I don't think this is going to be misused.
I am going to bring up this subject in a minute, because there is a story that does relate to this, but we're going to take a break. Glenn Fleischman is here. It's great to have him from Glenn.fun. You read his stuff every... What is there one publication that, you know, would be the place to mention, or is it just everywhere?
Well, I've kind of focused on Macworld. I write the Mac 911 column.
Oh, that's right.
I write books for Take Control Books. I don't put
those
out.
Did you take over
from
Chris on the Mac 911?
Chris Breen, and it's been, I've lost track, 7 or 8 years now.
Yeah.
I've written like 1,500 columns.
Wow.
But he wrote thousands before me.
Yeah, he did it for
years.
Yeah.
I still get email, dear Chris, I know you can help me with this problem. Like, sorry, he went to go to that grapefruit company in a different part of this world.
Chris, is he working at Apple?
He's there are many former, the largest percentage of ex-Macworld staffers, I've never been a staffer, are working at a fruit company.
It's amazing.
Working
amazing.
At Apple.
Shocking.
It's and great for them. It's great. Some of the best people at Macworld, some have formed their own groups, like Jason Snell, regular guest on this show, has Six Colors. Dan Warren works with them there. Some folks have left the Mac writing field, and everybody else just about went to work at Apple. And so they're doing great. You can see Serenity Caldwell is the face of WWDC.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry we can't see her doing like the tech stuff she used to, because she's internal. But boy, it's so fun every year. It's like, oh my gosh, it's Serenity, and she's the voice of WWDC.
It does, though, speak a little bit to the kind of enmeshment of Apple Press and Apple Corporate. I mean, you certainly don't want to see a revolving door where they join Apple and they come back out and they start writing for Macworld again. And stuff
Apple
like
almost
that.
Never hired Mac writers, it seemed like, for a long time. And then when there was I mean, you know better than anybody, Christina, because you were in that field for long. I mean, I've never had a staff job, but it seemed like when there was the great bloodletting in the tech press world, Apple sucked in. I mean, Google brought in some great ex-New York Times people who went into Google editorial.
Yep.
Quentin Hardy, for instance, is at Google Cloud's editorial director. One of my favorite reporters, great person. And I don't know what he does there, but their editorial is good, I guess. So anyway, I think the big tech companies, it wasn't revolving door. It was kind of a lifeboat for a lot of people. It's like, all right, you know this stuff.
I wonder, though, because Google and Apple both have kind of hired a lot of content people.
Yeah.
Nathan Olivares-Giles, who worked for it, was an employee of us, got hired away by Apple. But they kind of disappear at Apple. I mean, Apple? What is Apple's content business? It's not Apple News. Yeah.
I have a little bit. I don't want to peek any kimono that I'm not allowed to. But they have a wonderful writing on, say, support.apple.com. For instance, the App Store, the Mac App Store, and the iOS and iPad App Store, iPad OS App Store, have terrific writing, and they have these articles that show up. So
that's interesting. So that's where the content is.
Somebody's writing scripts for podcasts, I know it's the marketing department is writing, the keynote stuff, but there's a lot of places in which expert people are writing this kind of great gap between like almost service journalism and how-to stuff. And Apple has a lot of, a million pages of that is being written by a lot of
people. That's a good point.
People.
A lot of Apple support documents really are service journalism.
Really?
Under the Apple.
Usually I'll find something and I'll be like, I wonder if there's someone I could write about an error I found. I'm like, no, I better not. I'll just mark feedback on the page.
Yeah. I have a good friend who was a speechwriter for Jean-Louis Gasset for years. And they hire very good, talented people to do their writing. They can afford to. It turns out good writers come cheap. And
thank you very much.
Yeah. but at the same time, I feel like there should be this impenetrable wall between people doing editorial content about a company and the company itself.
Absolutely. Well, it's kind of become one way, though, is because there's been so many layoffs and so many reduced
jobs. Yeah, I guess if you're out of work, you got to take it down.
I don't know anybody who's come back from the tech.
I know a couple people who have, but it's very rare. You can certainly do it. And I think, like, because I sometimes think about, and people have even approached me about things.
You went to Microsoft, you were leaving a career as a journalist.
Yeah.
Was that a challenge for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, in my mind, I did have the question. I was like, well, am I still going to be able to have my own opinions and my own autonomy? And I will say my role is a little bit different. Like, I work directly with product and engineering people. I don't work in comms. I don't work in marketing. And so it's a little bit different than how the transition usually goes, someone writing the internal press releases or doing the press outreach or things that would be easy for me to do, frankly, but not intellectually interesting. So it was a little bit different, but yeah, I did definitely have that question. Like, what will I be giving up? Could I come back and could I cover tech objectively again?
A long time, we actually did not have you on our shows, but I missed you.
Yeah. And I appreciate that. I was glad to be able to, I got permission.
You weren't really, you weren't exactly in marketing. I mean, you were in dev relations. So I felt like, we have a lot of people who do developer relations for companies on the show.
Exactly. I mean, again, like I said, what I do, it's a little bit different than some other things. And also, I've been lucky to work at places that have much more open policies in terms of how active you can be on social media and whatnot. Right. And my bosses have recognized, and I'm very thankful for this, that like it is good when I can be myself and not having to parrot, a corporate line, right? Like that's it's good for everyone.
That for me was part of the judgment. Can I expect Christina to be a Christina bot or the real thing? And you've always been the real thing. So there was never a question.
No, I mean, and I think that was a big thing for me too when I made the decision to join Microsoft. Like, I'll be candid, I would never say never to any company, but if I was going to take a job someplace where I was not allowed to still maintain my own brand, my own identity.
You had to relocate.
And it was. And so for me, it was one of those things where I said, if I'm going to do this, then I still need to be able to have that external presence too. And if a company had said, you can't do this, and I talked to some who definitely had that kind of philosophy, look, I'll never say never to anything, and there's always a price, but the price is probably going to be a couple multiples of what you would agree to pay me if I'm going to give up all the other aspects of what I've built for my career. But I know that's also not the same for everyone.
Yeah.
The big picture is that, as Andreessen says, software is eating the world. And so I have a kind of a unique perspective because, and so does Glenn, during the decade of the 90s, the press had massive power and tons of money, and the tech industry had a lot less, relatively speaking. I mean,
PC Magazine could make or break a company like that.
Windows Magazine, which I work for, PC Computing, Macworld, et cetera, they had so much power because, first of all, we were still kind of a gatekeeper. There wasn't a global internet of people, amateurs working for free to create great content. And secondly, the companies were much smaller. If you look over time, you see the world of journalism in terms of business just shrinking. And a company like Apple just growing. And now Apple's the most gigantic company in the history of mankind. And the publications are laying people off, every few years. So
I hadn't really thought of that. That makes a lot of sense that there was a need for these jobs. So thank goodness these companies stepped up.
Yeah. So if you're going to explain things to people, it's not going to be, you make a much better living working for Apple than you do trying to scrape it out on your own as a journalist.
Speaking of which, one of our favorite contributors on the show, Wesley Faulkner, has a new job. He is now Senior Community Manager at Amazon Web Services. So
Yay, Wesley.
Congratulations, Wesley. I think that's really good news.
I brought up Lex Fridman. Lex Fridman's one of the people who's been selling ads in the podcasting world for longer than anybody else. And I joke with him.
Yeah, he pioneered it, basically.
Oh, yeah. He was one of the first. He joined Earwolf early on. But he was a Macworld writer. That was kind of his dream job. And then he found out he was really good at selling podcast ads. And now he was acquired by his latest firm. He was acquired by Amazon, I think it was last year now. So he's an Amazon employee after going from Macworld to Stitcher and McClatchy and like this whole series of acquisitions. He's at Amazon. So everybody worked at Macworld is at some interesting company.
That's really fascinating. Yeah.
Or is Jason Snow? There's always Jason Snow.
Whatever happened to Jason Snow?
I don't know.
I wish I could see him or hear him on podcasts occasionally.
If he would just do a podcast. I don't know.
He's very shy.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Actually, we have some news about Jason Snow, but that will come at a later date. Let me, now that I've teased you, talk about... Do any of you use Zapier? I'm such a Zapier fan, a sponsor for this segment of This Week in Tech.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, it's so great. We use it as part of our big workflow. So whenever I bookmark a story in a variety of places, I have a Zapier script that will automatically post it to Twitter, post it to a couple of places, but then also put it, post it on our Twitch social Mastodon instance, but then also put it in a spreadsheet, Google spreadsheet, for our producers so they can quickly import it into our show rundowns. That's just one of many things you can do with Zapier. I want to point especially to people in business. If you're trying to grow a business, and you know how many hats you wear, how many things you do, wouldn't it be nice to eliminate the routine operation tasks at your time? Still get them done, but have them done automatically. Things like lead management, employee onboarding, customer support. Zapier does that. And you're not coding, but it's kind of like coding. It actually makes it... This is one of the things about being a coder. You know that if you would just take a little time, you could get this thing done automatically and you never have to spend a minute doing it again. But it's sometimes it's easier just to keep doing it over and over and over again. That's why Zapier is so great. It makes it easy to connect all your apps, automate routine tasks, streamline your processes, do the things a computer is really good at doing. It doesn't make mistakes. It does it the same way every single time. It does it automatically. It does it without you thinking about it. It frees you up to do the things you're good at. To use your big brain to prioritize customer and client needs to make your business succeed. It's the power of automation possible for everyone. You don't have to be a coder. I use Zapier, love Zapier, and I'm always thinking of new ways to use Zapier. It makes it easy for anyone to get started with business automation, no coding necessary. And Zapier has the biggest collection of apps, 4,000 of the most popular apps businesses use every day. So I mentioned Google Sheets, for instance, Twitter, Google Sheets, RSS feeds, QuickBooks, Facebook, Google Ads. Imagine you have a whole process that automatically buys some Google Ads every time you announce something, this and that. It's you can automate just about any workflow imaginable. And by the way, you're not on your own. They have thousands of templates to get you started, to give you ideas, to show you what to do. The average user, Zapier sends me an email every week saying how much time I spent. The average user saves over $10,000 in recovered time every year. Getting a Zapier subscription would probably be the best thing, the best money saver you could imagine. No wonder 1.8 million people and businesses, including me, use Zapier to streamline their work and find more time for what matters most. We use it like crazy at Twit. See for yourself why teams at Airtable and Dropbox and HubSpot and Zendesk and thousands of other companies use Zapier every day to automate business. And if you're just, you know, home automation, if you're doing stuff around the house, you know, it's really fun to use Zapier. I have the lights, you know, dim at sunrise. I mean, it's just so many things you can do with Zapier. Try it for free today at Zapier.com/twit. Yeah, free trial. Zapier, Zapier.com/twit. It'll be amazing. You won't believe the things you can do with Zapier. Thank you, Zapier, for supporting Twit. And thank you for supporting us by using that address, Zapier.com/twit. This is a story I zapped this morning over to my pin board. I found this interesting. There was one line in it that was particularly interesting. You probably saw this in the news. Department of Justice seized phones from two attorneys involved in the January 6th probe. John Eastman, the Trump campaign legal advisor. Jeffrey Clark, the former Justice Department official who was supposed to become attorney general. But this is where I found it interesting. There were iPhones. John Eastman claimed he left a restaurant on June 22nd, and federal agents confronted him, took his iPhone 12 Pro, then served him with a warrant, and then, quote, he was forced to provide biometric data to unlock the phone. Now, that stopped me right there in my tracks. I thought that was very interesting. First of all, the federal agents knew enough to say, not give him a moment to react. Take the phone first before you give him the warrant. And then, it's an iPhone 12, so I think what they probably did is say, hey, John, look here.
Look, yeah.
Is this your phone? And then it unlocked, and then they probably had a Cellebrite tool or something similar, plugged it in, sucked all the data out of it. Now, of course, they kept the phone. It's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, January 6th was a while ago, like a year and a half ago. They still think there's something on that phone that's worth it. A judge obviously did. He wouldn't have signed the warrant.
Yeah. Well, before we move on, I don't think it was look at is this your phone? Because they didn't say they tricked him into
force. No, I think they compelled him. They forced him.
Forced.
So they stood on, you know, sat on his chest, and the two people grabbed his ears, and you know, who knows? I mean, what does that mean? Forced? I mean, that's just
they probably told him,
and this is my guess. My guess is that they probably told him, if you do not use your phone to unlock, use your face to unlock this, we will arrest you. This is what I'm guessing happened. I mean, I don't know, but I'm guessing that that's how they compelled him to do it. So, versus with other biometric stuff, like your fingerprint, your password rather, like they can't force you to give them the passcode.
Well, and that's where this gets really interesting. So the Fourth Amendment, of the Constitution, protects you against unreasonable search and seizure, and the Fifth Amendment protects you against incriminating yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where courts have gone, by the way, in two different directions. But the gist is biometrics is not self-incrimination. Putting your fingerprint on a fingerprint reader or your face in the Face ID is not self-incrimination, where giving a passcode would be.
This is why everyone should learn the quick presses that you need to do
the double tap.
John Gruber had a piece in during Fireball saying, hey, by the way, just so you don't know, here's how you can lock your phone real quick before the Fed sees it.
I do that when I'm in the airport. Like, I absolutely do that, right? I've been doing that for years because I don't want to be in that situation. I will say, and I'm only being a little bit flippant here, but it would be nice if a constitutional law scholar, we can question many of his other things, but it would be nice if a constitutional law scholar would have maybe declined to unlock his phone and actually force this issue. Like, I'm sorry, but like Eastman is a constitutional law scholar. This would have been
his business.
To be completely candid, like putting it how you feel about his other like credentials aside, I don't really care. I don't agree with him on many things, but it seems like this was a really missed opportunity for what could have been a really, you know, interesting legal case by someone with his credentials. If he had just basically said, no, I'm not going to unlock my phone. Like, I don't know. If it's were me, I would like to think I would go to jail. To me, I would like to say, and I can't say this definitively, I've not been in this situation. I don't want to be in this situation. But to me, I would like to think that I would spend a night in jail.
He may have felt like that would look like incriminating behavior. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like he had something to hide. I have to think.
Constitutional law scholar. I don't know.
Yeah. I have to think a year and a half after January 6th, if there is still something on that phone, I'd be shocked. What could be on there? I mean, I would think he would have. I mean, maybe he didn't think. Maybe he says, I didn't do anything wrong, so I'm not going to wipe my phone. I'll keep all those texts.
Evidence of witness intimidation?
Yeah. Maybe because that's recent, right?
Yeah.
That's recent.
Question is, none of these people, I mean, not these people meaning, you know, the Trump officials, but nobody in government and nobody above a certain age just about is very clever with this data at all. You keep hearing these cases where people, you know, they didn't wipe anything. They didn't, you know, they're posting pictures with GPS coordinates. So you want the raw data because it's often just right there.
John Gruber, a week ago.
Have we learned nothing from the mafia? I mean, genuinely.
Well, I remember.
The mob is good about this stuff, right?
I remember talking to some Secret Service agents many years ago who said, it's not a big deal. They almost always give us the password. Crooks, fine, whatever. They're not, I don't know. Anyway, just in case you don't know, there have been courts that have ruled that you have to give that password. Who was it? Was in jail for 2 years for contempt because he didn't unlock his hard drive. He was an accused child molester, and he apparently thought there was something on that drive. He didn't want law enforcement to see. Law enforcement thought there was something on the drive they wanted to see. He refused to give his encryption password up, spent some time in jail. He's out of jail, but never did unlock but he was imprisoned for not giving up the password. Right. And the courts at the time said that is not self-incrimination. And it had something to do with whether the police knew that information was on there or it was a phishing expedition.
Oh, I see.
So it's
either way, it's a shorter sentence for sure.
Yeah, 2 years, much easier.
Pornography on there. Yeah.
So the theory is, and Gruber's theory is, what do you do? You tap this twice? I can't even remember now. You can make it so that it's not. Yeah, I think I...
Yeah, you just hit the button twice
And then it will go into a mode where you have to enter the passcode to get in. And the theory is now you've protected it because the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment prevents them from forcing you to give them the passcode, whereas the courts have ruled it is not incriminating to get your Face ID.
Here's what it is. If you're on like one of the newer phones, you press the lower volume button and then the side button at the same time.
Until
you're gonna feel a feedback. Like if you've got the vibration.
So you can
on,
have it in your pocket.
Vibration feedback.
This is what Gruber says. Exactly. You don't have to look at it.
Nope.
You just have it in your pocket. You go, here come the federal officers. You press the 2 and then it buzzes. And now it says slide to turn off. It doesn't matter what you do. You're gonna have to do. You're gonna have to do the passcode to get back into that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So you have it enabled. It's just basically these two buttons, and then
if you are an unindicted co-conspirator in the the January 6th insurrection, you might want to make a note of that.
Or to quote the famous XKCD strip, just someone brings up a wrench at you, and that's how you get the password. You're dealing with criminals or governments that don't believe in the.
Well, that's true. It's not going to work unless the rule of law is rock solid.
If you were in, the January 6th people, you don't need to get their phone. They posted the evidence.
Right. I was going to say they live streamed it. Like in many cases, they were literally live streaming it. So
they were taking videos and posting them. Okay. John says, never, ever hand your phone to a cop or anyone vaguely cop-like, like the rent-a-cops working for the TSA. If they tell you you must refuse, they can and will lie to you about this. Mm-hmm. If you really need to hand it over, they'll take it from you. And they won't get anything from it because you've already hard-locked it. and you know you cannot be required to give them your passcode. That really is kind of a little bit of a optimistic point of view. Like, yeah, they're going to have me in airport jail, you can't require me to give you my passcode. Well, here's a wrench. Yeah. Here's your head. Would you like the two to have a meeting?
Yeah, and then that's when they unplug the video camera in the interrogation.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow I... Yes. Anyway, I reading this article, I that caught my eye because he said they forced me to unlock the phone, to give them biometric information. I thought that was very interesting. You're right, Christina. Here's a constitutional lawyer. Why did he do so?
Although, weirdly, the warrant, I'm looking again here at this is from the CNN article here. The warrant said that they couldn't force him to give up biometric information. So he's claiming they did.
And that's why he's saying
it voluntarily.
Now I get it.
So then that could be the fruit of the poisoned tree.
There you go. He knows what he's doing. Yeah. He is using his constitutional noggin.
And there may be a great deal of exaggeration. I mean, Rudy Giuliani said he was assaulted.
I know.
And somebody,
this is true.
You know,
I had a whole conversation. My kids were laughing at Rudy Giuliani being hit, and I was like, "Look, he's an old man. He's clearly not in good health. He's not a well-being." Somebody came up, and then I saw the footage. I'm like, "Oh no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't mean to be a hard in. I just don't want you to laugh at an old man being hit. I don't agree with assault.
I'm very sorry.
No one should be touched without their permission. I believe in bodily autonomy, all right, the guy just tapped. He just touched in the back and said, scumbag. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Beat me up. What do we think about crypto's crash? Let me just check.
Yay! Hooray!
Yeah.
Sorry.
19,200. You know what? I think it has a lot to do with how much Bitcoin you have.
I was going to say, I think it depends on how exposed you are. I mean, look, my Robin Hood adventures with my Dogecoin stuff, I did get my initial money out of it. The additional stuff I put into it, I did not. But I'm so down, which is it's hilarious to me. But I'm not exposed. Like I do worry about the businesses, like legitimate businesses and banks and finance institutions that heavily exposed themselves to this stuff when it was going up and up and up. Like even if we all, if the collective wisdom on this panel is to be more skeptical of crypto, if not against it, I tend to be more on the skeptical side rather than just anti. I think that we can agree that having this level of the kind of downturn is not great. I mean,
Well, I feel for anybody who lost the rent money on it. I think we've been, at least in the last year or two, pretty clear that you would be mistaken to put Bitcoin in your 401k, let's say.
Absolutely.
And I even am pretty down on NFTs. I feel like NFTs are absolute scams. What were you going to say, Glenn?
Yeah.
It's just when you have celebrities, I think that the
scammer, Matt Damon saying, fortune favors the brave. Buy Bitcoin.
I think this was the joke before the joke, quote unquote, before the Great Depression was like when your cab driver is giving you stock tips, you know that the market's about to fall, right?
Yeah, because that's right.
It's not that individuals shouldn't be invested in the broader market because the market as a whole over any long period of time, like there's 15 plus years, it has a high rate of return relative to almost every other thing you could put your money into, but it's when you buy individual stocks or bonds, you invest in gold or other, you know, commodities or something as completely speculative as Bitcoin or Ethereum, you're almost guaranteed to fail over the short term, even if there's a good long-term response, because you can't, unless you have a certain amount of money, you can't summon the resources to stay in during the downtime. So, I mean, I feel for all the people who were talked into it by celebrities where they're like, this wouldn't be on television and Matt Damon or other people wouldn't do this because they, you know, this isn't, I don't know. We're not talking about, so Dan Aykroyd and his Crystal Skull vodka or something.
Which I have a bottle of, by the way.
Is it good?
I haven't opened it, but Dan Aykroyd did autograph it, but then I smudged it because it was on glass.
Oh.
So I have a bottle signed by
But I'm sorry, but I just mean that, like, you know, when you get retail investors being convinced that this is an investment that can't go down, or being promised things in a way that there's a dispute. I'm blanking at which currency right now is frozen withdrawals, and they had a literal FDIC inaccurate thing that said your deposits are protected by the FDIC.
And they're not.
They weren't.
People
are posting, and I think they're claiming that they didn't have anything. I don't want to mention the name of the company because I can't remember the name at the moment, but the nuance was, like, they're claiming they never did, and people are posting pictures from, chat sessions with customer support. They're posting pictures from our Internet Archive of what they said. So if you're an individual, how do you deal with fraud? So I feel for all those people. The Winklevoss twins, do I feel for them? They are probably still up like 12,000%. Even if they're down, 60% for the year.
Yeah.
And they have a band. And unfortunately, their band is not called the Winklevi. But I think, the problem is that, as you mentioned, Glenn, everything you said points to the fact that everybody looks at it like an investment. It's supposed to be a currency. And this is this sort of the desire to get rich quick without employing anyone, without building anything, making anything, feeding anyone, is, I think most of us on this show talking till blue in the face about what ultimately a dangerous, risky thing it is. Leo, you're the best poster child for the risks of password management.
I still have my wallet. Let me point out, I got it. I just can't get into it. That's all.
You just can't get into it.
Yeah.
But you were
my wallet
is
FDIC insured. I want to.
That's right. You get it replaced by any leather wallet you want.
I mean, the fact is the value goes down. People want to buy in, et cetera. It may come back, may not.
Buy the dips. As long as the dips are the bottom and not the top.
Yeah, I stuck some more money into my, this is not financial advice, but I stuck some more money into my IRA when it took a big dive because I'm like, well, this is the,
Yeah, you're young yet.
I'm young,
I've lost 25% on my retirement.
Oh, just hold on, Leo. It'll come back. But I mean,
I have to work for another 10 years. That's all.
Oh my gosh! Over any over any extended period of time, the stock market on average,
that's right.
It performs very well. Yeah, it's just, do you have the wherewithal to not go, when this happens? It's very hard.
Yeah.
And some people don't have the money to not, or they've got
my favorite ad was the FTX ad with Larry David on the Super Bowl. That's the equivalent of a cab driver giving you a tip. When you see these crypto companies starting to advertise in the Super Bowl, we're somehow at this peak thing.
100%
bubble. Larry David as the boomer saying, oh, the wheel is a terrible idea. Coming up, everything's a terrible idea. And then they ask him about coin, terrible idea. And I know what I'm talking about. I would never get, which was mocking people of my age for saying, oh, crypto's no good. And the implication is, boomer, you just don't understand the modern world. Well, now there's a lot of boomers going, I don't think Larry David, by the way, was paid in Bitcoin for that commercial.
No.
It did get me interested, though, in FTX, which, by the way, is now buying up all the failing
all the other ones,
crypto
I was gonna
companies.
Say.
This is a very interesting company. Sam Bankman-Fried, who founded it, is 30 years old. He's worth $24 billion, of course, according to Forbes. He got out of he was in at Stanford. His parents were professors at Stanford Law School. He was born in the Stanford campus. He went to MIT. He blogged. I love this Wikipedia post. He blogged in 2012 about utilitarianism, baseball, and politics. Graduated with a degree in physics, a minor in math. Started working at a capital firm, Jane Street Capital, in 2013. He quit in 2017, moved to Berkeley. Get this, where he briefly worked for the Center for Effective Altruism, a nonprofit. But in 2017, he founded Alameda Research, which is a quant trading firm in crypto. He's one of the guys who made the most money on crypto.
Right. He got in right before, I guess.
Timing.
Yeah, because he got in before 2017 when that had that peak, right? But then it fell down. He probably reinvested and
he made a lot of money in arbitrage, taking advantage of the higher price in Japan compared to America. So he'd buy in America, sell in Japan, and make money that way. He founded FTX in 2019, 3 years ago. It's now worth $24 billion and is buying up all of the failing cryptocurrency exchanges.
Oh, he may make an offer for Robinhood, is the latest news Bloomberg reported on that a few days ago.
And he paid, what was it? He paid pennies on the dollar for BlockFi, which was one of our advertisers, I should mention. BlockFi, which was worth at $1 billion, it was ended up, he gave them $250 million, loaned them $250 million to stay solvent, and then took advantage of that. And I saw one report that said he bought it for $25 million.
Yeah, but I saw that too.
I don't think that's, I think it's more than that, but still, talked about pennies on the dollar.
I think when I was on a few weeks ago, but it just keeps coming back, is I think the real underlying problem isn't necessarily all the various currencies. It's the stable coins, right? It's like the false promises.
Well, and Terra was the one you were thinking of. I think that people
right.
thought
Terra,
it was backed by
Tether
US FDIC.
Is bleeding. And,
Tether,
I mean, all the algorithmic and the supposedly reserve-based stable coins are what pushed up valuation, and we're seeing it completely unwind as the trust ebbs out, and you're having
runs. Because then you have people like Deutsche Bank, which just said, "Oh no, Bitcoin is going to the moon. Hold on to it." They say the $2 trillion crypto crash could be coming to an end. They compare Bitcoin to the $72 billion a year diamond industry. You might wonder how many Bitcoin Deutsche Bank has. I bet you they know their wallet's password.
Well, they're also getting a lot of agreement. Inflation. They're also getting a lot of agreement from the president of El Salvador, who just he said, thanks for the cheap Bitcoins, and he bought another $1.5
He bought more?
Bought more.
Double down.
I really want to see a bank in Germany talk about hyperinflation of currency.
I know. It's going to be great. You're going to have so much money, you'll have it in wheelbarrows. It'll be amazing.
Yes, you'll literally have to use wheelbarrows to buy your zucchini or something.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Let's take a little break. Lots more to talk about. Great panel today, Glenn Fleischman. So glad to have you, the expert in so many things, including typography and what are they called? Flongs?
Flongs.
Those little things that
I have.
He's a flong master. Get ready for this. You collect sneakers, he collects flongs.
I acquired hundreds of Peanuts flongs. These are printing plates from Sweden, where they were being used in English language Swedish newspaper. And so here are Peanuts comics from the 1970s in color separations. This is the black plate for color Sunday strips. So I've been scanning these, and then
what is the copyright? Is the Charles Schulz Foundation going to come after you here? I mean,
well, it's an interesting thing. As an artifact, I can certainly scan it, but I can't sell or reap rights. It's a very complicated. Right. There must be some fair use issues. And then here's an alley-oop cartoon.
Oh man, look at that!
Oh my gosh,
that would be used to create part of the newspaper printing process. I just got this. This is from the 60s. But then here's the best thing. It's a ridiculous thing. It's from 1917. Someone I knows that I love flung.
God.
This is a printing plate raised to type high that would be used in a newspaper, and it's a terrible, terrible old strip. It's a really one of these horrible early, but it's 1917, so no one knew how to make comic strips yet. They're like the punchlines are confusing and whatever. So anyway, but it's little pieces of comic syndication history.
I love it. It's a museum. Now, are you actually in your office or is that a green screen?
This is really stuff. I can put
Oh, wow. Amazing. Look at that.
Look, the book moved. I know. I fooled you once.
First time he was on, he completely tricked me. It looked exactly the same. And then he reaches back and just agrees.
I was using a bokeh photo.
Very well done. It's beautiful. Brilliant.
No, this is what I'm calling the Joe Schlobotnik Flong and Stereotype Museum. That's my working title.
Thank you, Joe.
Those who are Snoopy fans.
Yeah, nice. I never knew that's how you pronounce it. Schlobotnik, huh?
Maybe Schlobotnik.
We don't know. Also, Mike Elgin is here. Gastronomad.net if you want to go on these great trips. The next one in Provence this fall.
That's right.
Amazing. Amazing. We went last fall to Oaxaca with you guys, and it was the best thing. It was so much fun.
We're going to be hanging out with some of the people you met there, so I'll tell them you said hi.
Please do.
Okay.
And, please do.
Yeah.
I follow Julia and Charlie on Instagram, and I was watching all of you guys in Provence, and I thought, oh, that lavender looks good enough to eat.
So much fun. So much fun. Yeah. Yes. And by the way, we if I can do a quick plug, the Provence experience in the fall has, we still have an open room. So if anybody wants to join us, go to the website, gastronomad.net, shoot me a line, and you could grab that last room. It's going to be mind-blowingly beautiful.
And amazing. And you'll be amongst friends because there are many twit listeners in the groups. It's just by coincidence, somehow, magically, it just happens. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yep.
There's Julia herself with a baby goat. How cute is that? Christina Warren, also here, film girl. We love Christina. It's great to have you and your sneakers on the show.
Great to be here.
And your travels are done now for a while, or are you going to...
For now, I'm not sure when my next thing will be, but I will be traveling more, obviously, as the, you know, the year and next year goes on. Yeah. But
that's good for GitHub. It's different. You go to build, you go to those events, or is it something different now? Is it like
So we have GitHub Universe. So is in November, and that'll be at the Moscone Center in San Francisco.
Oh, fun! And you'll be there. This way. Nice.
Absolutely. Just, you know, more things, more events are happening in person and opening up, and we're just kind of figuring out, like, our fiscal year just started this week. And so we're, you know, figuring out where we want to be and whatnot. And some people would rather stay home and would rather be virtual. I would rather be out.
You like to travel.
I do like to travel. And it was really great being able to be around people again and be at, you know, meetup groups and things like that. It was really nice to, be able to have that experience again because I've missed it a lot.
And of course, we missed Film Girl's impromptu hotel tours.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm glad you're back doing that and showing the world what it's like to be Christina Warren traveling.
I was going to say people shockingly, it's probably been some of the most popular content I've ever done where for years I was doing, this is before Reels existed on Instagram. I might bring it to TikTok. I don't know. But I was doing them as stories and now I'm doing them as Reels and I might bring it to TikTok. But I do my Christina's hotel room tours where I just do a tour of the hotel room that I happen to be in. Started doing it. People shockingly, I've had people come up to me at like conferences and things, people who don't really know me and are like, oh, I love your hotel tours. I'm like,
okay. So funny. You just don't know.
I had a friend who just took, I took him 4 days to get from Virginia back to Portland.
Travel's tough right now.
I have not been on the road, so I've missed it so far.
And what's interesting, you know, Friday, which was the first day of the 4th of July weekend, by the way, happy Independence Day to our American viewers.
Yes.
Happy Canada Day a couple of days ago to our Canadian. Mm-hmm. Friday, which was the beginning of the weekend, there were more people went through the TSA lines than they did in 2019. Oh, it's actually gone up.
Yeah.
So it travels back.
Travels back, but there are less crew members. I was going to say the pilots aren't. The TSA people aren't. Yeah. The whole thing. This is what happened.
They're calling it Airmageddon.
Airmageddon, baby.
We have a fun situation. We got global entry just before literally January 2020. The whole family, all four of us went up to near the Canadian border and took a little vacation. Mm-hmm. This is great. It's January 2020. We have this wonderful trip planned this summer. So much travel ahead of us, we thought to ourselves. But global entry, once you're in it, you have to go back up there when your passport changes, all this stuff.
Yep.
So we can't use it now when we start traveling again without going back to this small town near Canada.
To go to the same place that issued it?
Yes. And you can't.
Okay, I don't know that.
I think you can just link it back to your new passport because
maybe they've changed that.
Yeah, I'm almost positive. Mike would know more than me, but I'm 99% sure that all you have to do is update your forms on the Global Entry website to link to the new passport.
Oh, no, you know what? We have Nexus. We don't have Global Entry.
Oh, that's the problem. You have the Canadian border. You have Canadian Global Entry.
It seems so smart. We're so close to Canada.
There's a guy in a Mountie hat. It's a whole different thing. It doesn't
Canadian very nice about it.
Yeah, Canadian Entry.
I'm sorry. Nexus is a great program.
No, it's better than Global Entry, except for that.
Except when the border shuts down for 2 years.
Yeah, except for that.
Global Entry, though, is fantastic.
Global Entry is great, right?
TSA pre-check, but the use of face recognition. I mean, we just half the time we come back into the country, we just look at the camera and they're like, okay, thank you.
Isn't that amazing? I just got Global Entry coming back from Oaxaca. I did my interview at SFO in the middle of the night and got my global entry. So,
oh, well, you'll appreciate this. I went for global entry first. That's why I was confused before we decided to do the Nexus about 6 months later. And the guy said, oh, so you're, he just asked me these, you know, a few questions. It was going really well. It's, you know, these very brief interviews, right? And he said, oh, I see you're a writer. What kind of stuff do you write? I'm like, oh, and I just list off a few things. I'm just like trying to not set off any red flags. And he says, oh, sounds like you're pretty smart. You should go on Jeopardy. I'm like, well, I was on Jeopardy.
Of fact.
Then he couldn't believe me. So I had him Google to find a picture of me with Alex Trebek. And then he starts telling me about his own memory. And I'm like, oh, my God, you should be on Jeopardy. You and me, this CB, you know, Customs Border. I'm like, he's like, well, if I read a sports trivia book, I memorize the whole thing. I'm like, you need to be on the show. Go audition. So I hope I talked him into it.
You're having a much better experience with Canadian border guards than I had. So, in fact, than anybody I've ever met has. So, congratulations. You've made some friends. That's good. Our show today brought to you by We Use Text Messages. Everybody uses text messages. Podium is the ultimate text messaging platform for small businesses. I think this is something we learned, actually, in the past couple of years. It's been tough. I'm not going to, you know, candy coat it, from supply chain issues, overwhelming demand. On top of everything else that business owners have to manage, you know, hard to find employees. But the businesses who thrive in adversity like this are the ones who are forward thinking, who use new technologies. Podium helps your small business stay ahead of the curve with modern messaging tools that make it easy for your customers to connect with your business. You've probably already been through this cycle. You know, first you had to have an answering machine on the business line so people could leave a message. And then, you had to have a website. Then you had to have, you know, a Facebook account and an Instagram account. And it moves all the time. Well, let me tell you something. We have learned during the pandemic, people love text messaging. I mean, how many times have we used text messages to let us know our food delivery is on the way, to order food? A lot of people, I'm one of them, don't like to call a business, whether it's a plumber, a landscaper. I don't like phone tag. I don't like to leave long messages. Text is so much easier. So if you're running in a business and the only way to get in touch with you is a phone number, you're kind of like, you know, before you had a website, right? Podium gives businesses the tools to compete with the convenience offered by bigger businesses like Amazon. It takes your small business and makes it a big business, at least from the customer's point of view. From healthcare providers to plumbers, over 100,000 businesses are texting with customers through Podium. And while customers love the convenience, businesses love the results. Like the car dealer who sold a $50,000 truck in just 4 text messages. Hey, I've got a truck. You're interested? A jeweler sold a $5,000 ring, coordinated curbside pickup, all through texts. There was a dentist. He had a lot of outstanding bills. People hadn't been paying him. Turned out it worked really well to do his collections through text. 70% of the outstanding invoices were paid in just 2 weeks. With Podium's all-in-one inbox, your employees will love it too. You can do more than just chat. You can get online reviews. You say, hey, thanks for visiting our business. Would you like to leave a review on Yelp or Google or wherever you like those reviews? You just send the link. People are much more likely to respond. Click the link, leave the review. Great way to collect payments fast from anywhere, to send marketing campaigns that actually get a response. You know, on average, text messages get read something like 93% of the time. The open rate is so high on text messages compared to any other way of contacting customers. Just send a quick text. It really works. Customers love it. Your business will thrive. See how Podium can grow your business. We've got a demo for you. Podium, podium.com/twit. Take a look. Podium.com/twit. Podium, the better way to grow your local business. Let's grow with Podium. Thank you, Podium, for your support, by the way, of This Week in Tech. What about, actually, now that I'm with some people who use Instagram, is it me or does Instagram looking more and more like TikTok?
It is not just you.
There's a little TikTok envy. In fact, they've announced now that all video you post is going to be a reel, right?
Yeah.
Is this a good strategy? It makes me feel like it's like they're copying and they're not.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
Again, yeah.
Facebook is a company with zero vision. And what they do is they just copy every you know, remember they copied Snapchat wholesale. Then they copied Google Plus.
It worked with Snapchat though, right? Snapchat, they tried to buy them. They couldn't buy them. So they didn't put them out of business.
Made it better. No, no. I think that I have to say, I have to give them a little bit of credit. I think that their implementation of stories was better than the way Snapchat's was, just because Snapchat really was leaning into the ephemeral at that point. Right. And I think that, that the way that they did stories and some of the things they did to their editing experience was better. On the flip side, I think that they are a far worse TikTok clone than you know, like the Snapchat stories. But to Mike's point, yeah, I mean, if you look through the history of Facebook, I think Instagram's a little different now. The founders have left, but, you know, and I think that the guy who's in charge now, I don't think he has the product vision, but I think that, you know, Facebook is its history is littered with examples of times when they have taken inspiration from other, you know, companies and attempted to release things that very rarely have worked out. I mean, honestly, like WhatsApp and Instagram have been two of the, I think, leading reasons why Facebook has maintained relevance over the last, you know, 19 years or however long it's been
around. Yeah, Kevin Systrom, who was the founder of Instagram, one of the founders of Instagram, left Facebook quite famously in a dispute over what the direction was. They replaced him with Adam Mosseri, who was a Facebook lifer, in effect.
Yep.
He is not the product visionary that Systrom was.
No.
And ever since, I think, Instagram has gone downhill. And I want Instagram to succeed. It's the only Facebook property I still use.
Same.
And it used to be a great place to share photos. Not anymore. Yeah.
Well, Facebook has actually done one of their famous copying routines more recently than the copying of TikTok, which is that they've made Facebook groups look exactly like Discord. They made it purple. They have a sidebar.
That's
on the
really
left.
Really awful. It drives me nuts.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, anything that's hot, they just sort of steal the, you know, the core elements of it and try to
this
get
is
in
such,
on that.
Look at this. This looks so much like Discord. It's blatant.
Oh, my God.
It's blatant.
And I have to think that this is what's so weird to me, because I have to think that the demographics and your users for Facebook groups and your users for Discord are completely different. So I don't even understand what the appeal is to make it look like Discord, because it's not like you're going to bring the teens and the kids to Facebook groups. They're not going to ever use that. Right. And yet the people who use and really enjoy and get things out of Facebook groups are going to be like, okay, why did you move this? And why does this look like this thing that I'm not familiar with? This makes no sense.
It does seem misguided. You're exactly right. You're annoying the existing customers, and you have no hope of luring people away from Discord.
You will never, ever lure the other people in. I mean, like Facebook gaming is famously tried for years to take on Twitch. I mean, look, YouTube gaming has tried to take on Twitch. Nothing is going to take on Twitch, right? Like you know, Microsoft tried with Mixer, failed.
I want Instagram to succeed. I briefly moved to Glass, which is an Instagram replacement created by photographers, photos first. They're trying to respond to all this stuff. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's not as big. It doesn't have the social. Whatever it is, it doesn't quite scratch that itch. But I was an early adopter on Instagram, and I thought that was a great thing. Yeah.
It was. I think that what's weird too about like the, I understand approaching, you know, and YouTube has done this with shorts a little bit too. I understand approaching some of the types of content and maybe the editing tools and the length and the format adoption of TikTok. I see that. And I mean, and I think that that's why the stories appropriation worked, right? Like I think that it was a format rather than necessarily taking on some of the way that the, you know, Snapchat worked, which was Snapchat was always a very personal one-to-one thing. Instagram's a little bit broader than that. It's people you know, but also people that you might, you know, want to follow and keep up with. TikTok was fascinating to me about it, and this isn't universally true, but I think this is largely true for people, is that it is one of the few social networks that's come out basically since Facebook, if we want to be honest, your social graph is not at all based on who you know. It's based on, you know, things you're interested in and things you follow. But you don't necessarily, like on TikTok, I don't follow anyone that I know in real life. Like, there might be a few things.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I don't do that.
By the way, follow away. I follow my son, and I never see his TikToks.
This is sort of my point, right? Is the way that they feed you content, the reason why it's
even when I go to the following tab, he's not there, and I know I'm following him, and I know he's putting them out. I have to actually search for his name.
You have to search for him because you're not typically consuming his type of content that he's creating. Whereas I think
if he would do more bikini rich content, I might see more of his stuff.
If he would do more bikini rich content, yeah. Or maybe if he should do collabs with some people, then maybe you'll see him on your For You page. Yeah. But until then, but again, this is where I think that the Facebook thing is a little bit misguided, or Instagram thing is a little misguided, because look, you might also follow the bikini models on Instagram, but you're largely there to see people, at least I think historically, people that you know, and to share things with people you know.
Right.
Whereas Reels, the whole idea, if they're going to make it like TikTok, then you want to see stuff from people that you're not connected with. So to me, it feels like a mixed, like a completely false experience like setup. Like if I want to follow people that I don't actually have any connection with and see short form videos about it, that's what TikTok is for. I don't want to suddenly be inundated with
completely different paradigm.
Exactly. I don't want to be inundated with that on Instagram. And I don't think that Facebook quite understands that. Like I again, to your point, the product vision isn't really there.
I don't know if
Here's
I'm
a question.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Leo.
Well, I was just going to say, sorry. After you had a fall.
Delay. okay, I'll go. So first of all, does Hank make you call him Salt, or do you still call him?
Hey, Salty.
I always wondered about that.
Hey, Salty.
But here's a question, because I normally like to crap all over TikTok and criticize them harshly.
I'm actually in love with TikTok.
But here's a question. Does TikTok actually expand in human empathy and understanding?
Yes.
Because there's so many videos from, like, you know, Nairobi and, like, you know, all these far-flung places.
It does what we
thought
the internet was going to do, which was open up the world. I think it absolutely does. Plus, for creators like my son, it's an opportunity. He couldn't have done what he's done on any other platform.
Right. And I launched him in other platforms. He's like on...
Look at Megan Salter, who's now on Hacks on HBO. She did her comedy. She was a comedian. COVID, she couldn't do her bits, so she created this crazy something that would have never worked anywhere but TikTok. These crazy short form characters became huge on TikTok. Now she's on HBO. I think this is a really good place for creators of a certain type, right?
Right. Yeah. You know. Absolutely. I saw a glimpse of a show that Shakira has where they have these people who dance on TikTok. They're discovered on TikTok, brought onto her show. And it's like, it's played as if the Shakira show is the big time and TikTok is the small time.
Yeah, it's the other way around.
Right. And it's really
the other
opposite
way around. They're just trying to glom on to
They're trying to glom on to it. Exactly.
My son has 2.1 million followers on TikTok. That is more than any show I do. He has completely eclipsed anything I've done in 40 years in the business in a matter of months. I don't know where else you could do that. Now, I don't know what the successor to that is. And I feel bad. I'm the parent who goes, now, son, you don't pull all your eggs in one basket, you know, and all that. And he's going, yeah, dad, but right. Yeah.
He literally does in some of his videos. He puts eggs in baskets.
He puts eggs in baskets. What? And he doesn't save any extra. Yeah.
If you measure it in minutes, though, I think that's minutes consumed, given the length of your shows versus his TikToks. Maybe it happens.
Maybe. User minutes? Should I measure it? So what? Is this just me, or is this something you guys have in your Instagram? This is something I thought was new. Up at the top at Instagram, there's now a little down triangle, and I can choose from favorites and following. And I think this is. Can you do that, or is that?
I can't do it on mine.
Maybe I'm in a test.
I was going to say, I don't have this.
So I like this because I favorite the people. Now this is just like the old Instagram. It's just people.
Yeah, they said it was coming back.
Yeah, just people I'm following.
Oh, no, I do have this. Sorry. Okay. Following and then favorites. Okay,
I never saw it before. I saw it a couple of weeks ago and I thought, so maybe this is their way. Admittedly, it's hidden away and who knows who has it. But maybe this is their way of saying, well, you could, just like Twitter, rather. Twitter, you can do latest tweets. Which is a chronological feed of people you're following. I love that.
Yeah.
Or you could do the home, which gives you, you know, and that's good too. There are times when you want to see stuff you might have missed. So maybe this is a new way of doing this. You kind of have it both ways.
The sneaky thing in Instagram is that deal where they show you things from other people you follow.
I hate that.
Yes.
It just shows up. I don't want to see that.
Then you close it and it says, do you want to snooze this for 30 days? Like, well, I want the never, ever do this to me.
Never, thing, ever.
Right. Every 30 days, I start seeing random things.
And it's made up, too, because you followed, because you watched a video by this person. Levy, I paused on that for 2 seconds. We thought you'd like this one. Is not a good system. They're just annoying. I'm very disappointed. And trying to be more like TikTok now, I think every video is a reel. Suddenly it's reels, reels, reels.
And yet they haven't even copied like all the good things.
None of the good stuff.
From reels. But it's like reels now don't have like TikToks rather don't, you know, have like the time limit is much, much longer and reels are limited to 90 seconds. It's like, okay, what's the point then? You know, like you're making me use this subpar version of this copycat when I would rather consume the content on like the platform that has the admittedly scary as all get out, but very, very effective algorithm. Like, I don't know.
Speaking of TikTok, I mean, there's still some concern about the fact that it's owned by ByteDance, a Chinese company, that there may be Chinese employees looking at stuff. And in fact, even though TikTok announced that they were going to put all the U.S. users' data on Oracle-based servers in California, apparently they admitted only carefully vetted Chinese employees have access to the American data. TikTok is working on a deal with the Biden administration that would, quote, fully safeguard the app in the U.S. You know, obviously they don't – look, there's nothing the Chinese government is getting from this that is worth what TikTok is getting from American users, right? But does TikTok have a choice?
It's not up to ByteDance. And, you know, one of the problems is that I understand the psychological satisfaction of hosting data in a certain country, but does hosting U.S. user data in the U.S. on Oracle servers prevent ByteDance from accessing the data that their app is generating? I mean, I would have to see.
Apparently not, because that's what they, in their letter they wrote to 9 Republican senators that was released just Friday, they admitted, no, our certain employees can see American data, right. Even though it's not stored in China, they can see it.
Right.
So and, pointless.
I just find it very, all of it, there's a lot of effort to try to put fears at ease, but it's not, you know, at the end of the day, ByteDance is a Chinese company. And by the way, a lot of people don't know this, but TikTok is itself banned in China.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
ByteDance has another version called something else. I forgot what it's called, but which is fully censored by the Chinese government, et cetera. But yeah, even TikTok is banned in China. It's incredible. But I just don't, you know, the Chinese government will, if it wants to, get any data from ByteDance that ByteDance has access to, no matter where it's stored.
Yeah.
So it's really not about where it's stored. It's about what access ByteDance has.
But so what? What are they going to get out of this that I should be worried that the Chinese... I'm much more worried about what Facebook knows about me than what Chinese government knows about me.
The location of U.S. soldiers, the movement of
U.S.
soldiers.
It's completely reasonable for the U.S. Armed Forces to forbid the use of TikTok.
They can say that, but
how right.
Well,
but
that's their problem, not my problem. They need to handle that problem, not me.
What I'm saying is there's this Project Texas thing, which is a so-called collaboration.
Isn't that an ironic name?
ByteDance. Yes, it is. and this is where, you know, this is where the storing on Oracle servers, et cetera, comes in. And so what I'm saying is that we need transparency around exactly what they're doing, because I don't really trust ByteDance or the U.S. government or Texas to actually safeguard this data unless I know how they're doing it. How exactly are they preventing the company from accessing its own data?
Right. But you've said this yourself, Mike. The threat from ByteDance of TikTok isn't so much harvesting American citizens' data. It's slanting American citizen opinion.
It's disinformation.
It's disinformation. Yes. That's the real risk. This doesn't address that at all. right?
There is also another issue, though, because there's a lot of, it's not just, the data may seem unimportant, but the Chinese are monitoring hundreds of thousands or millions of Chinese, both Chinese Americans and Chinese citizens living in the United States, and researchers and people doing work. You know, this is the whole thing years ago when China was deemed to have broken into Gmail accounts related to people who were, you know, writing about or human rights advocates connected with China and so forth. Is China will use any information that they can get that helps them understand and track a very large swath of people. So that is that risk comes across any data China gets access to, and TikTok gives them a lot of that for those citizens.
Well, those
and non-citizens.
I hope this doesn't sound callous, but if they don't want to be tracked, they shouldn't be using TikTok on their phone.
Well, that's. Yeah,
it's not my problem. If you were a Chinese dissident in the United States, you'd be nuts to use TikTok on put TikTok.
It doesn't
need
to be dissidents. You can be a Chinese. I mean, you know, there's been these articles.
Don't do it. They shouldn't do it. If they're worried about it, that's their problem. It's not my problem.
Okay, it's not your problem, but I would say this, because and I think there's some fairness in that, but I would say, okay, the way that we know that location and other information can be aggregated, we know that people who are not personally like wanting to be identified with it, how their information can also be assimilated and put into those things. Like, okay, so let's say they don't use it. That doesn't mean that certain information about them couldn't be inferred because of other people who were in the data set, right? Like, I think you could still be putting people at risk.
So if I hung out with a group of Chinese people and they didn't have TikTok, but I did.
Right.
You could be putting them at risk.
Yeah. Fair. All right.
Then I don't want to overstate it, but it's also, I think, the unfettered access by any government to information about that, you know, includes stuff that can be by like location, voice, face, content, opinion, all of these things. Do we want, even though it's publicly available, it's not publicly available in the same degree to which it could be accessed off servers. The Chinese have developed enormous capabilities to do voice and facial and other recognition on data sets because they're using that against their own citizens. So that the risk is that the Chinese will use it. Maybe they'll use it as techniques to, you know, they could be using it for to try to turn turn military people, to turn people in academia. There's just I don't want to make China out to be this ridiculous international threat, but I think they work extremely well in their own interests. Well, I don't want to overstate it. I think they work extremely well in their own interests. And I'll let you say it because I don't disagree with it.
I'm more afraid of my own government than I am of China. If I were a woman in this country, a young woman of breeding age in this country, I'd be especially afeard of my own government. I think there's a lot more at risk from that.
This is fair, but we potentially have the ability to affect what our government does in this country, and we can't do it with China. And I think China is more avowedly interested in creating, you know, I think Russia
can't
to
do as much
discord.
Harm to me, though, as the Texas Attorney General can.
I don't know.
Well, we can oppose them both, but the point is that one of the problems with the Chinese, yes. I mean, you talk about contentious political issues in the United States. The point is they're contentious.
Right.
In China, there's no contentiousness about anything. It's like, and Xi Jinping is proved that he wants to be North Korea, but with like way more money and a lot more people and a lot more power and the ability to be a superpower, which is to extend military power globally. So our own government is more concerned about screwing us over, but we can do something about it, as Glenn said. And it's a conversation. It's the lack of conversation, the lack of democracy in China that makes them, makes us as technology consumers have to think twice about what we're consuming and who's behind it and all that sort of thing.
You wrote a good piece in Computer World last week. Sort of about this, with this notion that it was foolish ever to think of a global internet. That wasn't going to happen.
That's exactly right. And you know, the buzzword is the splinter net, and the splinter net just keeps splintering more and more. The biggest, of course, the big split came with the Great Firewall of China. You use the internet in China, it looks nothing like the internet we use. They don't have access to Wikipedia, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat.
TikTok I've just learned. Yes.
Yes. And we don't have access, or we don't have, you know, we're not really using these other things. Meanwhile, not only is China good at keeping their own citizens from seeing uncensored content, they're increasingly censoring globally, which is a big concern. Then you had Russia kind of wanted to have a wannabe Chinese Great Wall of China. But the war in Ukraine just accelerated that massively, where you have lots and lots of people, U.S. companies are pulling out of Russia, Russia banning all these social networks that they used to not ban, and so on. So that they're becoming more China-like in their disassociation. But you have other things happening. You have similar things. They're essentially intranets in North Korea, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and a bunch of other countries. You have a book by somebody named Nina Zhang, who wrote a book, Parallel Metaverses. And her contention is the same point that I made in a column a few months ago, which is there's not going to be a metaverse. There's going to be many, many metaverses, and they're going to be, some of them are going to be very compelling, and people are going to live within them. You'll live in yours, I'll live in mine. So it's another, the two biggest trends, metaverse and Web3, are major splintering factors on an already splintered net. So the metaverse is going to be splinter people. Web3 is going to splinter people, because they think, you know, the vision of the Web3 is we'll just get everybody on the Web3 stuff, on blockchain stuff, on distributed networks and so on. Well, a minority of people will embrace that version of the web, and the majority will stay on what they call Web 2. So that's another splinter. So we're being splintered every which way. And the idea that we're all going to go back to an internet that we all share, where there's, you can't censor it, et cetera, is just never going to happen. It's just going to get worse and worse and worse, unfortunately.
We need to bring back Gopher. That'll solve it.
Archie and Veronica.
And Archie and Veronica. Exactly. Actually, her point's interesting, but it's not just national metaverses. We're going to have splintering of metaverses within the U.S. There'll be Facebooks, there'll be Apples, there'll be Microsofts. And they're, you know, even though they've formed this metaverse alliance, it's not clear that there will be interoperable metaverses.
Right.
I think it's much more likely that Facebook's going to say, no, you want to play in our space. We've got the coolest outfits, you know,
which is unfortunate, because I think the whole reason that the web won, right, and the whole reason that, you know, versus the online networks and the internet superhighway of that motif, I think the whole reason the web won was interoperability.
And
I think that, you know, we might have been naive to think that we could have one global internet, but I think that the reason the internet has been such a massive success and that the web has had such a, you know, like uncalculable like impact on society, global society, I should add, has been because until recently, with a couple of exceptions, it has been one place.
You know, there's been a lot of negative about social media, and we've been talking a lot about it on our shows. And is it good? Is it bad? It's a source of disinformation. Can it bring people together? There's some positives, some negatives. I thought this was really interesting. I don't know if you watched the January 6th. Testimony, the congressional testimony. But there was a retired Republican judge, Michael Luttig, who was, I thought, really interesting. I remember very well his testimony. And I also remember thinking, well, he's sort of speaking slowly. I wonder if he's recovering from a stroke or something like that. He's not. But Joe Hagan, who's a writer for Vanity Fair, in a Twitter thread said, I like how this guy treats every line of his testimony like he's engraving it on a national monument. And frankly,
he's
really
talking to the stenographer, not to the public.
He really is engraving it for history, and he seems to know it. To which Judge Luttig responded on Twitter with a Twitter thread. Thank you so much, Mr. Hagan. You almost presciently understood precisely what I was at least attempting to do to the best of my abilities during the hearing Thursday. He even mocked his own speech pattern. He says, what you could not know and did not know, but I will tell you now, is that I believed I had an obligation to the select committee and the country first to formulate, .. then to measure, .. and then, .. to meter out every single word that I spoke carefully, exactingly, and deliberately, so that the words I spoke were pristine clear and would be heard and therefore understood as such. He said, I believe Thursday I had a high responsibility an obligation to myself, even if to no other. And please bear in mind, it was the first time in 68 years that I'd ever been on national television. I wasn't scared. I wanted to do my best and not embarrass myself. But then the most, I thought the most interesting thing was that I decided to respond to your tweet because I've been watching the tweets all day suggesting that I'm recovering from a severe stroke.
Oh, no.
And my friends, out of their concern for me and my family, have been earnestly forwarding me these tweets, asking me if I'm all right. Such is, this is the thing I wanted to bring up, and it's germane to this program. Such is social media, I understand, but I profoundly believe in social media's foundational, in fact, revolutionary value and contribution to free speech in our country. This is a 68-year-old, wow, pretty conservative, right-wing, yeah, Republican judge who one would expect would say, oh, social media. No, no, he says, for that reason, I'm willing to willingly accept the occasional bad that comes from social media in return for the much more frequent good that comes from it, at least from the vastly more responsible, respectful speech on those media.
I totally agree with that.
Isn't that awesome?
He's absolutely right.
That's amazing.
And I think it's great that somebody who's 68 and conservative is honest enough and perceptive enough to come to that conclusion, because I think that's absolutely true. And it would be more true for a lot more people if more people would learn to block and report.
Yeah, true. He says one more. Let me just finish his tweet, Storm. One more thing, and then Glenn. This is why 16 years after my retirement from the bench, he tweets, even then, as a very skeptical, curmudgeonly old federal judge, I created a Facebook account and then a Twitter account. And again, he mocks himself slowly, very slowly. One account first and then followed by the other. All of this said, I am not recovering from a stroke or any other malady, I promise. Thankfully, I've never been as sick or so debilitated as that ever in my life. I would not want that from anyone, knock on wood. So Judge Luttig is fine. He was intentionally speaking very carefully and precisely. And he appreciated the response on Twitter. Amazing. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yep.
Well, I have breaking news here from 1860. live coverage in the social media of the day, which were newspapers, which were often put out in multiple editions a day.
I remember.
Coverage of Mr. Lincoln's speaking style. He's rather unsteady in his gait, and there is an involuntarily comical awkwardness which marks his movements while speaking. His voice, though sharp and powerful at times, has a frequent tendency to dwindle into a shrill and unpleasant sound. His enunciation is slow and emphatic, and a particular characteristic of his delivery was a remarkable mobility of his features, the frequent contortions of which excited the merriment which his words alone could not well have produced. So
very nice.
There you go.
1860.
Very slow speaker.
And occasionally high.
Very high pitched.
A little bit.
But it carried. His voice carried.
It carried.
Daniel Day-Lewis nailed it.
Yes, he did. And I think it was partly based on that report. Hey, I want to take a break. A few more things to talk about. We're not going to wrap it up quite yet. I know it's been a long show, but I can't stop talking to these guys. Great to have Christina Warren, Glenn Fleischman, Mike Elgin. You guys rock. Our show today brought to you by Blue Land. You know, California is trying to eliminate plastic waste. I am in my life trying to eliminate plastic waste. Did you know that an estimated 5 billion plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away every year? They end up in the landfill where they never degrade. They never go away. Don't believe the plastic industry when they say they're recyclable. They're not. Blue Land wants to help you do the right thing. Eliminate single-use plastics. And by the way, it's also good for the environment, because when you buy a bottle of, you know, surface cleaner, multi-surface cleaner, window cleaner, dishwashing soap, laundry detergent, hand soap, when you buy those bottles, 90% of it's water. So you're transporting all this water around completely unnecessarily. With Blue Land, you buy these beautiful forever bottles. They call them Instagrammable. They're fantastic. This one is a multi-surface cleaner, so it's very lightweight. They have very solid, thick glass for the hand soap, the liquid soap dispensers, so that they stay there. They're very solid. They really are beautiful. You buy them once, and you refill them. But you don't refill. You use your own water. And the active agreements are sent to you in these little tablets. I love this idea. You grab one of the beautiful Forever bottles, you fill it with warm water, you drop in the tablet, and you get cleaning. Refills start at $2. You don't have to buy a new plastic bottle every time you run out. They're perfectly made. They're going to last for a long time. You can, of course, set up a subscription, which is what I do, so you never run out of the products you use the most. You save even more when you buy in bulk. From cleaning sprays to hand soap to toilet cleaner and laundry tablets, Blue Land products are made with ingredients you feel good about. In fact, the only thing you've got to dispose of is your notion that green, environmentally friendly products aren't good or are expensive. They are effective. They're wonderful. We use Blue Land everywhere. We wash our clothes with Blue Land. We wash our dishes with Blue Land. We wash our hands with Blue Land. And now, by the way, and I highly recommend these Blue Land, they've been out of stock for their toilet cleaning tablets. Those are back in stock. Stock up on those. Those are really fantastic. They work really well. In fact, what I did when my daughter moved into her new apartment, you can buy a whole kit. I gave her a kit to get her started. Their Clean Essentials kit, everything you need. Blue Land products come in wonderful scents, although we use the unscented laundry soap. But they do have some lovely scents. The hand soaps are great. I got a Christmas package. I smell like a gingerbread house every time I wash my hands. They have iris, agave, fresh lemon, eucalyptus mint. For a limited time, hand soap is getting a summer upgrade. They've been doing this all along. It's really fun. We've been using this for a long time. And I will go and get that when they have the new kind of limited edition scents. This summer, strawberry rhubarb, citrus patchouli, and coconut palm. It makes you want to wash your hands, I have to say. We've got Blue Land everywhere in the house. You will want to get 15% off your first order. Go to blueland.com/twit. These are products that work. You'll love using them, and you'll feel good about them because you know you're eliminating single-use plastics. And that's really been a goal in our house for some time now. 15% off your first order of any Blue Land product. Blueland, blueland.com/twit. This is a great deal. Take advantage of this. And again, if you've got a wedding coming up, a housewarming, just even a hostess gift, this is a great gift. People love it. Blueland.com/twit. We had a great week on Twit, I think. I wasn't here. I was visiting Mom. In fact, I'm going to watch with you as we see the highlights.
Taco Bell has announced a tostada on a giant Cheez-It 18 times the size of a regular Cheez-It. Now, this is important news. The Cheez-It tostada.
I'm never letting Jarvis host the show again. That's it.
Consumerism and technology. What does it take to make a giant Cheez-It? I mean, that's not easy, you know?
Previously on Twit. Hands-on photography.
Some of you folks are really curious about starting your own photography business. Well, I got to tell you, there's a lot of work involved, and we're going to dive into that.
Tech News Weekly.
Samsung Electronics announced that they have begun mass production of 3-nanometer chips. Yes, from 5 to 3. The newly developed first-gen 3-nanometer process can reduce power consumption by up to 45%, improve performance by 23%, and reduce area, of course, by 16%.
Security Now.
As of last week, finally, the masquerade is over, and the Conti ransomware operation has finally shut down its last public-facing infrastructure, which consisted of 2 Tor servers, which were used to leak data and to negotiate with victims. And, of course, no victims remain. So they're gone.
Twit. Friends don't let friends miss Twit.
We are going to have a good week this week. I am back, and I will be in the saddle for all those shows. Also, by the way, we just figured out that July 12th is going to be a big day. That's the day the first scientifically usable pictures will come back from the Webb telescope. 1 million kilometers, actually more than that, almost 1 million miles out from the Earth at Lagrange 2. That telescope is fully operational, and we expect to see the most distant stars we've ever seen. Going back so far that they're literally about 120 million years from the Big Bang. So this is the beginnings of the universe. So NASA's going to have a press conference, 7:30 a.m. Pacific, 10:30 Eastern on July 12th. That's a Tuesday. Rod Pyle, the host of This Week in Space, and I and anyone else who wants to join us, I think, John, you'll be joining us. We'll be covering that. So that's a little bit of an announcement on something we just decided, because I'm very excited about that. Now, John, you said you had an update on the giant Cheez-It story. You can order the Cheez-It tostada without toppings and just get a box of Cheez-It. Oh, Lord, help me now. I'm never letting Jarvis host Twig again. That's it. Actually, speaking about chips 3-nanometer, TSMC, which was supposed to move to a 3-nanometer process, apparently having some difficulty. And now that the Apple M2 MacBook Pro is starting to come out, we're seeing some negative reviews here from Extreme Tech. Apple's entry-level M2 MacBook Pro turns into a Celeron under heavy load. Ouch.
Yeah. But not unfair if you look at it. I mean, like, it seems like they cheaped out for whatever reason on the SSD for the entry level versus what we had last year. And so there is definitely a speed regression if you get the 256 gigabyte or 128 or whatever size it is.
Don't get the cheap one, in other words. The baseline is 256 and 8 gigs of RAM. According to Extreme Tech, the 13-inch base system gets as hot as 108 degrees Celsius, which is hotter than boiling.
It's very hot.
And that seems to very much impact the performance of the SSD controller. So, yeah, maybe a design flaw. This is not a new design. This is essentially the same design as last year with the M1. But the M2, maybe it gets hotter. I don't know. So just
I don't know, because they're using something different for the SSD. Like, they're from what I understand, they're using something different for the SSD. And then in their RAM, this is the big thing. Like, they're basically only using like one module rather than M2.
Okay. So I will just refer you to this Extreme Tech article and the YouTube video that spawned it. And I'm sure we'll hear more about this. We'll talk more about it on Mac Break Weekly. But basically, the advice of Extreme Tech is do not buy the entry-level M2 MacBook Pro. There are issues. There are issues. There's so many stories we didn't even get to. Let me see. Oh, you know, one of the things I wanted to do, more happy stories. And I don't know, Mike, you can advise me as a longtime editor. I have noticed over the last couple of years, and I've received some notes from listeners, tech has really turned negative. It used to be a little happier, right? We get excited about new products and talk about what the new phones are going to bring, and now it just feels like it's bad news after bad news. Is this a normal part of the cycle, the ebb and flow, or are we in a new era of tech? What do you think, Mike?
Oh, we're in a new era for sure. I mean, I think that back in the olden times, 80s, 90s, et cetera.
1860s,
The future was full of promise. The year 2000 was coming.
Yeah.
And tech, the people who were enthusiastic about tech was a tiny group of nerds who built their own systems. Like, you know, it was all about optimizing this, do that. You know, it was a lot of fun. The rate at which the performance of everything just was exponential, it felt like. And you know, so the thing about the, you know, how cameras have evolved on cell phones in the last like 12 years. But we're to the point now where, and this is reflected here in Silicon Valley as well. What used to be something that was, first of all, understandable, second of all, exciting, became this sort of money grab. Everything's gotten super complex. There's been this sort of inertia that comes with the entropy of an expanding industry. And so we have this situation now where so many people are using technology products that is having social effects, and many of these social effects are negative. Teenagers are getting addicted to social media, or, you know, committing suicide because Instagram makes them feel like, you know, they're left out and all this kind of stuff. There's all these problems that come from it. Governments have their hands in it, and good governments, bad governments, everybody's involved. And so we're in the situation where it feels like there isn't much good news. We don't really notice the benefits. We were talking earlier about, you know, how TikTok has this subtle ability to make you sort of see, have this little window, this quick little window into some faraway place and some completely alien context. Well, that's probably having a very beneficial effect. We don't have time to focus on that or notice that because we're so worried about, you know, the government tracking down people with menstruation apps to prevent them or jail them for having an abortion or whatever. So the bad stuff seems to just take up all the oxygen in the room and we can't really focus on the good stuff. But there is really, really good stuff, I think, happening with technology. It's just, you know,
I feel
it's
like
just,
I want to focus more on that. I don't want to,
yeah,
I don't want to be the, you know, the grim reaper of technology.
Yeah.
What do you think, Glenn? You're equally a long time in this business.
I find myself increasingly uninterested in technology, a fun thing to say on a show about technology. But it's partly because, like, the things that excite me still are the ways in which people's lives get improved. And so to echo what Mike was saying, really, is it's just the, you know, the focus. There's a lot of technology that is insidious because it's a race to the bottom. It's a race to grab eyeballs and attention and to do increasingly negative things because that's how the money is raised. And, you know, there's a famous example that I think is actually made up, but it's the psychology test where students in a psychology class start only paying attention to a professor when he or she's on one side of the classroom. And by the end of the term, they have the professor stuck in a corner. They won't speak unless they're in that corner because no one pays attention to them and they don't realize what's going on. It's a great reverse experiment. And I feel like everything in technology that involves attention and response puts us in that corner. We're all, you know, all the Facebook doesn't, maybe Facebook intentionally is not trying to allegedly contribute to genocide, but it does because that's a part of the technology they developed that allows them to reap such huge financial returns. So I'd like to look at enhancements and so forth. My wife has a bone anchored hearing aid, an earlier generation. She sticks a Bluetooth device on this thing that vibrates and it sends a signal to her ear and it connects to her iPhone. They added an upgrade a few releases ago. And so she can play music and phone calls into her head. And it's a huge improvement for her life. So the hearing aid by itself was great technology. Then the linking of it with Bluetooth and improvements in Apple's operating system make it into a superpower. It's a biological enhancement. In fact, she has abilities beyond people with so-called normative hearing. And I want to find more things like that. Like, I don't care so much about VR or AR. They're great entertainment opportunities, but I don't think they're going to fill all this zone. But I'm like, AR is such an incredible capability for younger people, for people with various disabilities that prevent them from having full access or full use of hearing, eyes, whatever. I think about, like, the thing that I keep coming back to in my idea of what the future should be is heads-up display painting our windshields in a car. I don't want necessarily automatic driving. I like warnings and things like that are good, but I want to be able to drive the road at night and have night vision on the inside of my windshield. And why not? You know, that to me would be an enhancement. It would reduce accidents. It would maybe not decrease alertness because it's enhancing your view. So I look forward to things like that. And also more cat pictures, please.
I feel like you're an optimistic guy, so I'm going to take a page from your joy in technology. I got into this because I love technology. I still love it. But it's so easy to get kind of burdened by all of the negatives and to start focusing on that. Christina, you're also optimistic. You're a very positive person, and you work
in technology.
I try to be. Yeah. I mean, look,
I think that it can become overwhelming to just look at, because there are a lot of terrible things that are happening in the world, and there are a lot of terrible things that have happened in the last 2 years. And technology is a force for good and it's a force for bad. But I think that on the whole of it, it has made our lives better. I know that my life is infinitely better because of technology, because of social media, because of the
cat pictures.
Web. Right. Yes. Yeah, totally. Right. Like, because of the way that I can communicate with people, like even what happened to us in the last 2 years, right? Like, as bad as that was, it would have been worse if we didn't all
imagine,
have, you know, the ability to communicate with each other over video chat. Right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even through text messages or phone calls. Right. Like, which needless to say, the last time we had one of these things, you know, 100 years ago, you didn't have that ability.
You just locked yourself in your room and
right. And
waved for help. And
to say nothing of vaccines and right. and the stuff that's happened there. So I don't know. I have to work at it because it's easy for me, even though I am a typically, like, I'm not a cynical person. I mean, I have cynical aspects, but I try to be a fairly positive person. It's hard sometimes not to be taken in by all the cynicism. I also don't want to be a cheerleader for the industries that sometimes I think that maybe in the past we were too credulous and we were too positive about certain things and allowed certain things to happen. So I think that there's a good and a bad, but I do fear sometimes when I read some of the coverage and I read through the lens of someone who loves technology, who used to be a reporter and now works for a tech company. And so I have a different perspective, which is good to have. Sometimes I worry that too much of the coverage is negative just to be negative, critical just to be critical. And I'm here for the criticism. I'm here for the pushback. But there has to be a balance. And I do sometimes wonder if we've swung too far in the other way. Like, we went from being way too credulous, way too, you know, laudatory, to now completely ignoring the positive things that can happen because of tech.
Leo, can I make a couple of points?
Sure.
Not to miss the forest for the trees. Talk about the forest a bit. First of all, Christina mentioned vaccines. If the coronavirus had hit in the 1970s, say, there would have been no working from home and no vaccine for 10 years. It's unimaginable. It's really unimaginable. But the forest that I'd like to talk about is my own lifestyle of living internationally, which the world has discovered because of the pandemic. People are working remotely, working from home. There's a sort of thing where people start working from their apartment in the city. Then they decide to move out of the city. Then it's like, what are we doing in the suburbs? Why don't we go to you know, South America and live in Colombia for a while? And the internet connectivity keeps getting better. We just did the Provence experience. We always do that in this 400-year-old farmhouse. The walls are 3.5 feet thick, but it's very modern inside in every way except the internet connectivity, which is a really, really slow, like 3G mobile broadband connection. Well, this is a good question. Well, we showed up this year, and guess what? They now have fiber.
Oh, wow.
In the middle of, like out in the countryside.
That's amazing.
Amazing. So people can actually live. And also, by the way, Starlink is available.
Starlink, I was
going to
say,
well,
is massive.
So you can do a full on, like, under the Tuscan sun, buy a derelict old farmhouse somewhere in the sunny parts of Europe, and you can build up this thing, and you can live in paradise, have a garden, have a beautiful view, have clean air, clean water, clean everything, and solar power, and you can have fiber optic like speeds, and make your living in paradise. This is an opportunity that has never been afforded to anyone in the history of mankind. And it's pretty great for those who really want to live that way.
Excellent. I feel better already.
I'd point out one more thing, if I might, which is that photography is an almost unalloyed joy that we breathe. And so we don't pay. It's like unlike Mike's example just now, it's like Wi-Fi is everywhere. I used to cover Wi-Fi very extensively. Then I suddenly was not a Wi-Fi reporter because it permeates everything. Then we got good cellular data. The abilities we have to take a good picture and to take as many as we want and capture great moments in our lives are incredible. And then I will call out, there's one thing that makes me consistently happy every day that is technology, which is I use the featured photo thing on my iPhone. I have it as a widget. And most days, Apple's machine learning comes up with wonderful images across every, and I've scanned photos before there were digital photos. So I have photos going back to the 80s in my library. And so every day I get a look at these great pictures of my kids when they're babies and photos from a few weeks ago and pictures of bees I took 20 years ago or some trip.
I love
it. And I'm like, and I don't have to go searching for it. It shows up. And so it's machine learning. It's a modern device. It's the access through the cloud to all my photos. And I'm like, it combines to this wonderful thing. And so I have a moment of happiness every time I open that.
I guess it really is a question of focusing on the benefits and the good stuff, because there's negatives and positives and everything. And you don't have to dwell on the negatives. We know they're there.
Then
there's Elon Musk and the Pope. Hey, one good thing, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award, being awarded July 7th to 17 luminaries, Denzel Washington, Simone Biles, Megan Rapinoe, John McCain will get a posthumous award, and Steve Jobs, 11 years after his passing, will be receiving posthumously the Congressional Medal of Honor. I hope that his wife, Lorene Powell Jobs, is there to accept on her late husband's behalf. I think that'd be very fitting.
And basically 15 years after the iPhone, right? Which,
yeah, like, that's right.
Which is, which I mean, it's hard to even, I mean, it is easy to remember what life was like before, but just the
really
seismic impact that this device has had.
I mean, yeah,
it,
yeah,
it really has.
Let's be honest. Let's be honest, it's not a knighthood like Johnny Ive got, but it's something, and well-deserved.
But Johnny didn't meet the queen. He only got Queen Anne, Princess Anne. So it's, you know, it's
good
not
point.
As good.
Yeah. Good point.
Fair.
All right. Final Jeopardy. The subject, the world of today. I'm going to pose this question to all of you. I will say that on this episode of Jeopardy, only two people got it right.
Oh, come on.
Partly because it was a monosyllable. This word was chosen as, quote, a noun that conveys the idea of a unit of cultural transmission.
Yep.
You know the answer, Christina.
I'm pushing the button. Nothing's happening. I don't hear any buzzing.
It's Final Jeopardy. You all get to answer. Oh, Christina Warren.
Meme.
In the form of a question.
Form of a question.
What is a meme?
Yep, absolutely right. I know you knew that, Glenn. In fact,
that's
probably everybody watching knew that. The word meme coined by evolutionary scientist Richard Dawkins. And it is, in fact, of course, part of our regular vocabulary today. Only two, only one out of the three got it right.
Only one of the three got it. That's wow. Because I was reading the question. I didn't even get to the end of the question. I was reading it.
You knew immediately.
And I was like, oh, yeah, got it. Like,
one person answered, It was not the best Final Jeopardy ever. And Glenn, I know you would have gotten that one. No problem
at all.
Two-time Jeopardy champion.
Three times correct in Final Jeopardy, but only one twice.
Oh, man, that last one, they got you. You didn't bet enough?
I didn't have enough money left. I said George Sands instead of George Sand, and I didn't have money left for Final Jeopardy. We'll never forget.
Oh, my God.
I've gotten over it. Obviously.
Dance with me, George.
Clearly.
Dance with me.
That. Oh, my God.
Ooh, sorry, Alex.
Glenn Fleischman, what a pleasure. Glenn.fun, always great to have you on. We will be back on Wednesday for This Week in Google. I hope we haven't exhausted all of your resources. I have a feeling we have not.
Not yet.
But if you wish, you can speak very slowly. If you
I like to use deliberative tones.
Thank you, Glenn. So nice to have you. Mike Elgin, God bless you. Give my love to Amira, to Kevin, to Princess Squishy Face, to Nadia, the whole family.
Thank you.
Gastronomad.net if you want to go travel with these incredible people to some of the most beautiful places in the world and eat and drink like a prince. It's amazing.
Yes.
Highly recommended. Mike also writes for Computer World, many other publications, and he's got a newsletter, Mike's List, and, of course, Elgin.com is the website for that. Thank you, Mike. Always a pleasure. I'm sorry we couldn't get together because I probably would have loved that wine, but, you know, such is life. Such is life.
Yes. Thank you.
Such is life in the COVID era, which apparently is going on and on and on. Christina Warren, a pleasure seeing you too. Although because I follow you on Instagram, I feel like I know every hotel room you're in. Senior Dev Advocate at GitHub. Her GitHub name is Film Girl. Her Twitter handle is Film_Girl. Yep. So is her Instagram. Anything else you want to mention or plug?
So I do two podcasts. I do one called Overtired, overtiredpod.com.
Wait a minute. I didn't know about Overtired.
Overtired is great. It's basically, we joke that it's a Taylor Swift podcast. It's not. It's really about some ADHD nerds who and the things that keep us up at night. And it's great. And then I also do
It's with Brett Terpstra. Oh, nice.
Yeah, Brett Terpstra.
Oh,
yeah.
Love and, Brett. Yeah.
Yeah, Brett's amazing. And Jeff Severance-Gunsel recently joined us as our third host. And I also do Rocket on Relay FM and with Brianna Wu and Simone de Rochefort. So
very nice.
When I listen to me, I've got other podcasts, but also, like, frankly, like my Instagram, but the hotel tours is really what you want.
When did you start Overtired? I'm gonna have to listen to that. That sounds really great.
Honestly, like 8 or 9 years ago.
What?
It's been intermittent, but we've been consistent for the last year, so we've consistently every week. Yeah.
I knew about Rocket. I love Rocket, so that's
Overtired had periods of inactivity, we should say.
Well, naturally, you were tired. I understand.
Exactly.
That.
Naturally, we were tired. I came up with the name, actually. We were at like Twitter HQ, and we were trying to come up with the name. I was in the elevator, I'll never forget, and I was like, I'm so tired. I'm overtired. I was like, overtired, that's it. That's
such a good name for a podcast. Wow, it has so many levels of meaning. Wonderful to have you. Thank you, all three of you. We really appreciate your being here. Have a great 4th of July tomorrow. Fireworks, grilling, fun, wave the flag. We're not doing fireworks here in Petaluma because of the drought and the fire hazard, plus the city's broke. So we're going to have a laser light show instead. Everybody bring your lasers. It's going to be great.
Love it. Love it.
We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. You can watch us live, live.twit.tv. Actually, watch or listen. There's live audio and video streams. If you're watching live, chat with us at irc.twit.tv. You can also chat with us in our Discord, which is purple, but really honest comes by it honestly. The Discord is actually my favorite new social media place to be. The conversations aren't just about the shows. In fact, our Discord has topics every geek would be interested in. No flongs yet, but
not yet.
But comics for sure, gaming, hacking, ham radio, movies, music, software, sport ball, travel, trivia. And you can even be part of our Minecraft server. All of this, plus ad-free versions of all the shows and the special Twit Plus feed, which has a lot of material that doesn't make it to the air, so to speak. And it's $7 a month, which I think is a great deal. And we would really appreciate it if you'd join us. There's also a yearly, what is that, $84, if you just want to pay once and get it over with. It makes a great gift, too. And it really helps us. A recession is looming. And we already see some decrease in ad revenue, and I think this is going to be as bad as it was when COVID started. So this helps us get over those humps. Plus, it lets us develop new shows, bring in new talent, and we've got some exciting news in that area coming soon. So please join Club Twit, twit.tv/ClubTwit. Of course, all of our shows are available for free after the fact on the website, twit.tv. Every show has its own YouTube channel, as does this show, of course. Best way to get the show probably be subscribing your favorite podcast client. You get it automatically the minute it's available. And now you have a great show to listen to on a Monday morning. Thank you for being here, as you have been, I think, many of you for the past 17 years. It is now once again time for me to say goodbye. Another Twit is in the can.
This is amazing. Bye-bye.